The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order today, Saturday, March the 21st. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Let me take this opportunity to thank our staff, not for just for today, but I'm sure for the weeks ahead. They've worked really hard to in the last week, and for them to work just way into the night last night to get us prepared for today's Saturday meeting has just been phenomenal. Thank you all very much. And then to the members of the public, thank you for being here. We're sorry that we're making you be here on a beautiful Saturday, but I figure you'd rather, I mean, it's your choice to be here. The committee is here, but we're glad to have company in room 15. We're going to start with Senate File 489, Senator Clark.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members.
Good morning.
It was a very foggy drive down here, but the sky has cleared, so I'm sure you will be able to have a good day and have a good committee hearing.
Is he talking about the big?
Madam Chair, we do have a couple of amendments. I don't know if you want me to go ahead and do that now before we get started.
Let's do that. Even though these aren't author's amendments, my assumption that I thought there are a couple of them that are technical.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And they're substantive in nature. Why don't we also
take a look at 823.
Senator Clark, are these the A2 and A3 amendment?
Yes.
All right, and which one would you like to go first?
I think the A2, that's pretty technical. It's picking up language.
All right. So why don't we have you... does it make more sense for you to incorporate in the amendments as we walk through the bill?
Actually, that might make the most sense, right, Madam Chair.
So and why don't... The A2 and A3 amendment are before the members. Senator Clark will talk about the A2 and A3 amendment where it is pertinent as she's walking through the bill.
And, Madam Chair, I also have Ms. Howe from the AG's office. And what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is I will make just a few comments about what we're trying to do here, and then we can go through the bill.
Very good.
Okay, excellent. Madam Chair and members, this body and the legislature, together with the governor, has in the past couple of years done a lot of work on predatory lending, on important things about people who have been taken advantage of in the subprime market. And our bill today, the bill today in front of you, is attempting to do some proactive preventative measures with regard to reverse mortgages. Reverse mortgages are most definitely appropriate in a number of situations, but they are not appropriate in all situations. As some of you may know, reverse mortgages are sold and marketed to senior citizens, usually 62 years old and above. Under a reverse mortgage, the company pays the senior citizen a lump sum or periodic payments using the equity in the senior's home. The senior typically does not need to repay the loan until he or she dies or moves. Not in that order, obviously. Reverse mortgages may be suitable, again, for some seniors based on their financial circumstances. At one point in my life, I worked for the Senior Law Project, and we saw people who came in with a variety of different situations. And this would be appropriate for some of them, but they were often confused about something as simple as Part B forms on Medicare non-bills. They weren't sure what they were. There are a lot of things out there that are fairly complicated. So one of the things I noticed at that time, and one of the reasons why I think this bill is so important, is we want to make sure that people really know what they're getting into before they make decisions. So because they're not suitable for all seniors, and frankly, you shouldn't have to get an attorney just to understand them, they can be an expensive way of obtaining financing. There are some troublesome aspects of reverse mortgage marketing, and those tactics may include marketing reverse mortgage to senior that bears higher fees and cost is less suitable to them than other available financing options, using easy credit marketing tactics similar to those that led to the mortgage meltdown by encouraging a senior to take out an expensive reverse mortgage to finance a lifestyle they otherwise would be unable to afford, while ignoring the risky aspects of those products. which may consume the consumer, that senior's home equity, and using high-pressure cross-selling where the seller or affiliate encourages a senior to take out a reverse mortgage only to put the proceeds into long-term insurance policy or long-term deferred annuity where the cost of the mortgage outweighs any investment gains on the new investment. At times we saw that even recently just in regular home equity loans where somebody might have been encouraged to take out a home equity loan to perhaps play the stock market. We're trying to make sure that seniors, where this is maybe their only asset, aren't getting into a situation that is not appropriate for them. So we've seen a spike in reverse mortgage fraud. The FBI has seen it, both with regard to excessive fees and abusive marketing practices. I think many of you may have seen the commercials that happen during the daytime. We don't have today Lutheran Social Services or AARP that have been very key to this this bill, but in the essence of time and given it's a Saturday, they are not here today. But I want to make sure you know that they are supportive of the bill. The bill has been through Commerce. We made a couple of key changes there. And so I'm going to just tell you briefly about the overall part of the bill, and then we will go ahead and make sure Ms. Heil can go ahead and walk us through it. First off, we're trying to require lenders to determine that a given reverse mortgage is suitable for the senior selling it before them. We do this in other parts of the law. We think it's important here. We limit insurance producers from cross-selling annuities, life insurance, or long-term care insurance products to a senior using the proceeds of a reverse mortgage. It doesn't mean they couldn't talk to them about other funds, but not with this. And for just for you to know, the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council supports this particular provision. Excuse me. It provides a 10-working-day rescission period. We reduced it from 30 days, in which a senior may rescind a reverse mortgage. AARP, that's very particular for them. That is an important provision. And we're trying to align Minnesota law with federal reverse mortgage lending requirements. So, Madam Chair, if we could have Ms. Heil just kind of walk us through the bill, and then we could talk about the amendments as we're going through it.
Ms. Heil, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Carla Heil, Assistant Attorney General. As Senator Clark said, this bill is intended to be preventive and proactive and to try to get in, have all reverse mortgage loans sold in Minnesota, not just those that are federally insured, also have the protections that HUD-insured loans do. And so with that, the first section, it is changing the language so it reflects the federal language. The second section is only technical renumbering. The third section involves counseling, and this was a change, and the federal government in October of 2008 did implement stricter regulations and guidelines. The counseling is not finalized, but what we want to do is ensure that the counseling applies to, again, all reverse mortgages sold in Minnesota. They must be referred to a HUD approved counselor. They have to be positively promoted, and the session goes 60 minutes. As Senator Clark said, Lutheran Social Services and ARP has talked about the benefits of the counseling, and that's a very key provision. Section 4 of the bill is where we have the First Amendment today. And this talks about lender liability. And the proposed language is to insert with respect to a mortgage that is not federally insured. So the HUD-insured loans, it would not apply. Instead, it is the proprietary loans. And we believe that the proprietary loans would be the most problematic, so we are limiting it to just the proprietary. Section 5, the lender responsibility in the A3 amendment, that provision would be deleted. That is a provision that the bankers have said would be the most problematic in making sure that reverse mortgages are available in the state of Minnesota. So that is the reason that the A3 amendment deletes that. As Senator Clark said, Section 6 goes with the right of rescission, and that is now just 10 days. Under the federal law, there is 3 business. We want to have an extra amount of time to 10 days for the right of rescission. And the language which has been changed is under the federal truth in lending law, the rescission is effective immediately, and the borrower is supposed to be in the same position as if the transaction never occurred, and that's what the language in the A2 amendment is, that the effects of rescission shall be the same as provided in Regulation Z of the federal regulations. And then we wanted to make clear also in Section 6 that the lender needs to send a receipt of the notice of the rescission and acknowledge that it is null and void, and that there would also be a satisfaction of mortgage. And the other part of that changes on A2 is makes it consistent throughout. As Senator Clark said, Section 7 is suitability because it is being marketed as financial planning. We feel that insurance, securities also have to decide if suitability is applicable, and that's why we believe it's appropriate here. In Section 8, it's applying Chapter 47 provisions to make it consistent. And as Senator Clark said, Section 9 is the cross-selling where you cannot encourage or knowingly use the proceeds of a reverse mortgage for annuity insurance. The federal regulations are still being proposed. This would be more strict to ensure that the reverse mortgage is not used for that.
Very good. Any questions from Ms. Hyle? Senator Clark, the requirement for the counseling.
Yes.
Are there counseling agencies or services in place right now that would be able to do this?
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, if Lutheran Social Services was here, that's one of the things they would be testifying to. They do this under the federal provisions, and this would be something that they and others would be doing. So there are people who are out there doing it, again, because of for the federally insured. We're trying to make sure two things. One, it applies to not just those reverse mortgages, but to any reverse mortgages. And then the other is making sure that the duration is at least of a long enough length of time to actually really talk about this, because there is a number of things that we think are important that the counselor would go through, and they believe that the legislation we have and the language is sufficient.
Okay. Well, one of the concerns I would have is for the lenders to somehow be caught in a bind, because they would refer people and the counseling services are not available. So,
and Madam Chair, I'd be concerned about that too, but they are available.
And then Senator Clark, how would Section 7, or maybe Ms. Hyle, how would Section 7 be implemented? Are you thinking of a form? Are they already currently doing this? Section 7, the suitability?
Madam Chair, for suitability, Minnesota statutes already have suitability, for example, in selling insurance, and also suitability for selling securities. So I would envision that the compliance mechanism for this bill would be similar to the compliance mechanism in those other pieces of legislation or statutes.
Meaning that it's implied in the process, Ms. Hyle? In the process, how they do the paperwork to reach a conclusion? Whether or not the deal gets concluded?
Madam Chair, I believe with the suitability that there are specific standards that you are talking about, and it's also with the totality of the circumstances.
Madam Chair, if you think about
Senator Clark.
Part of the reason why we have this in here is that this reverse mortgages are sold more as a financial planning tool than as a loan, so it makes sense that this type of a provision would be here, similar to, as Ms. Hyle was saying, with a security or an insurance product.
Okay, very good. Let's put on the A2 and A3 amendment, and then we'll have the people who are in opposition to this come and testify. Senator Betzel moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid moves the A3 amendment. That's deleting Section 5 of the bill. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have an amendment. It is not numbered, and it's got some handwriting on it. Ms. Pontius didn't see it till this morning. So it's typed, but there are some now it's more accurate with the references.
All right.
Excuse me.
References. Senator Clark, have you seen this?
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I have.
And you're okay with this? Any discussions with Senator Scheid and her numbers?
Madam Chair, it's just cross-referencing and saying that not only the Commissioner of Commerce may weigh in on these decisions, but this also, the 60A is the section 968.992, has to do with the powers of the Commissioner. And it just says that the chapter here that we're that Senator Clark is offering does not limit any other remedy. So I think it's an unlimiting kind of amendment. I appreciate.
Any questions to Senator Scheid on the Scheid handwritten amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any other amendments to put the bill in shape? All right. We have one other testifier, Ms. Beth Patterson.
Goodness sake.
Ms. Patterson, welcome to the committee. Pull the microphone really close to you because it doesn't amplify very well.
Thank you for having me. I am Beth Patterson, and for the record, my last name is spelled P-A-T-E-R-S-O-N. I'm with Prestige Mortgage Reverse Mortgages SIDAC. I have specialized in reverse mortgages for the last 10 years and am known as an expert in the industry here in Minnesota. I've done hundreds of loans through the years, both HUD and proprietary, so I have experience with all of them, and actually all of the proprietary products that were available in Minnesota I have worked with. And I have also worked with many of the different lenders in the state that are throughout the industry offering reverse mortgages in the state. And I'm proud to say that all of the HECMs, which are a home equity conversion mortgage, have been insured by HUD. That means that we have done a very thorough job. And we have had no rescissions from any of our borrowers during that rescission period. Additionally, I've written books to help borrowers understand reverse mortgages. And I care very dearly about our seniors and work very closely with senior advocacy groups as well as adult protection. Currently, there are no proprietary products available anywhere in the country, and there haven't been for the last year. While I agree in principle with the bill, there are some restrictions that will either destroy reverse mortgages in Minnesota or at least limit the options of lenders. HUD and RESPA do have regulations in place that cover both the HUD product as well as the proprietary ones. And just so you know, the proprietary ones, when they were here, were modeled after HUD's program, including requiring counseling, the terms and disclosures both in the application and the closing documents. So to add the proprietary products to be covered under law is a good thing. Some of the points do conflict a little bit with HUD and RESPA requirements, and I'm going to go through the bill as it and just talk on a little bit about each of the sections. The payment and repayment sections does need to be removed. It has been ignored, it appears, but if it stays in that the loan balance cannot exceed 80%, that will limit some of the borrowers from being able to do it, or they will have to pay the money back, and that means it's not really a true reverse mortgage, and there could be risks of lawsuits.
Ms. Patterson, you're referring to Section 2 of the bill?
Yes.
And I think
payment and repayment.
Yep, and I'm looking in your letter, and that's now I think the section is on line 3.22, which is not new language. It's current law that Ms. Patterson
is
referring
to. Correct. It is there. Okay. But and that's why I'm saying it's been ignored. It could be a problem in the future.
Okay.
And so that's my concern. Thank you. Counseling, I totally agree that we should add proprietary products to be done by HUD-approved counselors who are trained with the different proprietary products. Lender default and forfeiture, That was just changed to exclude the federally insured products. But if and when proprietary products come back, that may lead to that lenders may not be able to offer the proprietary products here in Minnesota, or at least what it may do is require them, because of their risks, it may require borrowers to pull 100% out of the funds. That could be, that's certainly not what we're encouraging for borrowers to pull the money out all up front. Lender responsibility is the section we just amended to remove. Am I correct?
Yes.
The right of rescission, the 10-day rescission will be very, very difficult and risky for lenders, which could be passed on to the borrowers, including higher costs being passed on to them. It is a mortgage transaction, and it does take time. Generally, 30 or more days from the time of application or the counseling until the closing to do the processing and then the closing, and then there is the three-day rescission period. Borrowers can cancel any time during that processing and have the right to control when they want to schedule the closing and or if they do want to schedule the closing. The loan will not fund until after the rescission, and anything longer than the three-day rescission period will impact interest rates, which will affect the funds available to the borrowers. Investors may require higher margins, and that's going to be in increased potential costs to the borrower, and that may also mean increased costs during the life of the loan to the borrower. Managing payoffs could be very difficult with a longer rescission period. Foreclosures, especially now because there's a timing issue of when the sheriff sale could be happening. Property taxes, when those are due, could also be an issue. Judgments or liens could get recorded during the longer rescission period, which would make the title companies more vulnerable, and they are likely to increase their title insurance, and that would also be passed on to the borrower. Property insurance, when that is due, and which lender is bound, it's kind of a gray area and kind of difficult to manage even with a three-day rescission. A longer rescission could be more difficult. And the investors purchasing the loans and HUD insuring the loans, there is a tight time frame in there, which will make a difference to the lenders and whether HUD will insure the loan and or whether the investor who currently is Fannie Mae will purchase the loan or whether the lenders are going to have to hold buy those loans back. Suitability is not black and white. Income, assets, and credit are not required to qualify for a reverse mortgage, and the loans are non-recourse, meaning there's no personal liability to the borrower. For suitability, I'm suggesting, and which is done and required, but we could make it tighter and make sure that it is required in the state, that we as lenders are required to provide two reverse mortgage options during the application, include the amortization, the total annual loan cost, important terms, good faith estimate, disclosures, and we actually are required to leave borrowers with sample closing documents at the time of application or within 3 days. So they do have time to even review the closing documents, as well as we are required to leave considering a reverse mortgage, which is a Fannie Mae booklet. So to just put that in, that those are required, would help protect so the borrowers have plenty of time to review the information with their family, their friends, attorneys, or their advisors. The biggest fraud revolving around reverse mortgages actually has to do with children and powers of attorney. And to address that, I added a suggested statement regarding the power of attorney, which is in my handout, including this, which is proposed amendments to the bill. Cross-selling, I totally agree that that should be implemented. As they mentioned, it is in the federal, but not. They're still kind of fine-tuning it, and just to put that in there, and I put suggested verbiage for that. Overall, I agree in principle. The handout is my proposed amendments, protecting seniors, yet not removing or limiting reverse mortgages choices in Minnesota. And my request is don't punish the seniors or those of us who are good lenders by the few bad apples, but go after and punish the bad apples.
Any questions for Ms. Patterson? Ms. Patterson, can you clarify a little bit? I'm a little bit confused by the 3-day, 10-day, 15-day of rescission in your comments.
On my handout where I said it may be 15 business days, or because if it is only a 10-day, if it's passed as 10-day rescission and it's 10 business days, then there's a difference of we don't count the weekends. We took that out? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. So now the days are okay based on what Senator Clark has shown you?
Other than I still think it still should be the 3-day rescission versus the 10-day, but that section about the 15 days would be different.
Okay, very good. Any other questions for Ms. Patterson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then Mr. Lemke?
Welcome to the committee. For the record, my name is Matthew Lemke with the law firm of Winthrop and Weinstein, and I'm here on behalf of the Mortgage Bankers Association, and I know you have a very aggressive agenda, so I'll be very brief. First, I just want to thank the author for working with us and bringing us in early on this bill. I think we all share the same goals on reverse mortgages, and that's protecting a potentially vulnerable population, but also at the same time, we want to make sure that a bill is crafted in such a way that the benefits of the product are also still available to seniors. So, as a result of the growth in the reverse mortgage market, lenders are becoming increasingly interested in making reverse loans. While MBA supports the entry of lenders in the market, we also understand reverse mortgages are marketed to a potentially vulnerable population, as I said. MBA wholeheartedly supports protections for these consumers. The consumer protections should include adequate counseling standards and a clear plan for the payment of taxes and fees for the mortgage property. A bill should also provide safeguards for consumers as well as the lenders. The proposed counseling, I'll just touch on a couple issues because I know Ms. Patterson went into depth on the bill. The counseling provisions, we strongly support the counseling provisions, and we think this is extremely important, and this is should be done, and we support that section almost in its entirety. The two issues I'd like to touch on are just the suitability protection and the cross-selling sections, and that's Section 7. I believe in the bill is the suitability and the Section 9 for the cross-selling. On the suitability provisions, we think those issues are better dealt with in the counseling rather than from the lender perspective, and we have some language that we'll continue to work with the author and the Attorney General's office on the suitability language. And on the cross-selling, we also think that there needs to be protections on the cross-selling for the consumer. But a full prohibition on cross-selling is not something that we think we can support. But we'll continue to work with the author on that as well. And we think that we're optimistic that we can come up with some language there that will adequately protect everyone's needs. Thank you.
Very good, Ms. Lemke. Any questions for Ms. Lemke or the other testifiers? Or Senator Clark, for that matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further discussions on the bill? Anyone else here who would like to testify on the bill and haven't been given an opportunity? Thank you. Senator Scheid, would you move the bill?
Madam Chair, I would. I would move that Senate File 489 as amended be recommended to pass.
And does this go to the floor? I think it goes to the
floor.
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Right. On the motion, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Clark. Sorry we made you drove all the way back, but... That was a good morning.
It's for a good reason.
Thank you
for your hard work on a Saturday.
Thank you. Let's see. Before we go to Senator Scheid, I know that Senator Pearsall is not here yet, but I'm glad that Senator Orman, I know you had to really get through traffic to get here. Thank you for calling us ahead of time. We wanted to... we're going to put out a document for all of you to look at and for the members. We are trying to... We're hitting a deadline, and we're trying to procedurally create what the best scenario is in terms of moving forward. Our two budget chairs, Senator Foley and Senator Higgins, have to put their budget bills together rather quickly. The deadlines are pretty tight. And in order to put their budgets together, they're going, or to do their budgets, they're looking at possibilities to put that budget together. But as they're looking at the options that are available to them to do their budgets, there are a number of policies that they are looking at. And these are policies, obviously, with rather large budget implications. Because of the tight timetable that we're operating under and the budget chairs are operating under, we're trying to find the most expeditious way to have the policy committee have an opportunity to review and look at what are some of those policies they are looking at potentially to help them craft their budgets. I didn't have a chance to yesterday. All this came together rather quickly. We were able to finalize sort of the universe of language that they are potentially looking at yesterday morning. I had a chance, Senator Ortman, to talk to Senator Limmer about this, and I don't know if the two of you had talked, but I tried to get to all the members of the committee yesterday to give you all a heads up about this procedurally. And copies of the draft document was emailed to all the members yesterday. We wanted to have an opportunity to have this document available to the public. It will be up on the internet electronically for those who are interested in looking at it. My intention is, and I want to recognize the graciousness of both Senator Higgins and Senator Foley for allowing us the opportunity to look at these provisions. Together as the three chairs, we felt it was important for the policy committee to have had an opportunity to look at this language and to have an opportunity to take some input from the public on the policy aspect of it. So, members, this is the way we're going to proceed. I would like us, I'm going to make, we're making this document available to the public for your review. I think that substantially a majority of the provisions that are in the SC 6935 document are bills in some form or another, maybe slightly modified. And so they shouldn't all be brand new, though some pieces may be. And so we want to make this document available this morning, available to the public. I want to get this out to the members. And then we will take testimony on the specific provisions on Tuesday from in the 3 o'clock slot of our meeting. It's my intention then that we will then on Thursday during the 3 o'clock slot be processing this bill. And once we've processed the bill, the document, then we will turn this into a committee bill, which will be introduced by me on behalf of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then will be sent to Finance. We felt that this was the you know, in the time that I've been here, we've done things like this in the Tax Committee, but I haven't had this experience in any of the policy committees. Senator Higgins and Foley and I felt that this is the best way to for all of us to be able to have the policy discussion, but also get the provisions to them in time. The way I would characterize these provisions is that this is putting together a toolkit of potential tools that will be available to Senators Higgins and Foley. Frankly, I don't know if any of us are necessarily enamored of any of the specific provisions. That being said, however, I also felt that it is during these extraordinary times, it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we equipped our chairs, our budget chairs, with the necessary tools that they may or may not use, but that they have a pretty tough job ahead of them in terms of their budgets. And let me say that I think all of you in this room, anybody who has had anything to do with the judiciary, clearly understands what tough targets our two budget chairs are facing. The document, I think, is now available to all of you. I'm going to have Mr. Backus walk us through the document. We will not take comments or testimony today. This is just taking the opportunity to make the document available. However, let me say that for members as well as for the public, if you are going to testify or if you want to take something out of this document, might I suggest to you that you offer up a suggestion in its place? I think it's only fair. Our two chairs have worked very hard, and to help us come up with some ideas. The policy committee may or may not want to tinker with this, because the idea here is that, again, to offer them a portfolio of tools that they may or may not use. So as you testify on this, as you look at this, if you don't like something, I would invite you to offer up something else in its place. I guess the document is now available on the Senate Judiciary website. So, Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, just for members of the audience and for the members of the committee, there are two documents that are now available. The first document is a Senate Council document. On the top right, it says SC-6935. It's structured as a bill, but it's a Senate Council document. As the Chair said, eventually it will be introduced as a committee bill. There's also a section-by-section summary that's available. And as the Chair said, if you go to the Senate webpage, senate.leg.state.mn.us, you click on the Senate committees, you click on the 2009 to 2010 committee information, click on Judiciary, and you scroll down to related issues, and both of these are posted there. In terms of the bill, beginning with Article 1, Article 1 contains a number of court-related fee increases. Section 1 requires that money from what's a new charge, a per-page charge that's going to be in Section 2, and the increased court fees, which are going to be in Section 2, are going to be deposited into a new account in the State Treasury called the Court and Public Defender Account. Section 2 increases various court fees, including fees for filing a civil action, requesting a jury, certified and uncertified copies, subpoenas, motions, executions, transcripts, trusteeship accounts, and depositing a will. It also imposes a fee of $1 per page on documents filed in court. Section 3 increases the surcharge on criminal and traffic offenders by $10 from $75 to $85. Section 4 deposits that $10 increase into this new account, the Court and Public Defender Account. Section 5 increases by $10 from $50 to $60 the filing fee for conciliation courts, and requires that that increase be deposited in this new account. Section 6 increases by $50 from $500 to $550 the appellate filing fee, and also puts that into the new account. Section 7 is actually establishing the new account. It's a it's an account in the Special Revenue Fund, and all these fees are going to be deposited there, and then they're subject to appropriation by the legislature to support the courts and the public defenders. Section 9 is the appropriations. What it does is it appropriates the money out of that account on a percentage basis to the Supreme Court, the Civil Legal Services, the Court of Appeals, the district courts, and the public defenders. And those percentages are based on the current funding for those entities. Article 2 then makes a number of changes for criminal penalties and deals with administrative penalties. Section 1 and then 10, 11, and 12 increase the statutory maximum penalty for a petty misdemeanor from $300 to $500. Section 2 addresses the criminal and traffic offender charge again. This time it provides that it will apply to a person who completes a diversion program or a similar program for a traffic-related offense. Sections 3 to 7 address the authority of local units of government to enact ordinance violations. What it does is it caps temporarily for 2 years their authority at a petty misdemeanor. Section 8 strikes language identifying specific locations for misdemeanor violations bureaus in Hennepin County. Section 9 provides that referees can preside over conciliation courts throughout the state. Currently, judges have to, except for Ramsey and Hennepin County. Section 13, Subdivision 1, temporarily converts misdemeanor penalties outside of the criminal code, the contempt code, the domestic abuse code, the DWI code, and the controlled substances code. These are for first-time offenses. They would temporarily convert those misdemeanors to petty misdemeanors for 2 years. Subdivision 2 converts all misdemeanors contained in ordinances to petty misdemeanors, and that's also for a 2-year period. Section 3 caps the maximum penalty that a local unit of government can impose for an ordinance violation at a petty misdemeanor. That's similar to what we talked about earlier. And then Section 4 provides that any misdemeanors that were converted into petties under Subdivisions 1 or 2 revert back to misdemeanors on July 1, 2011. Section 14 addresses specific misdemeanors in the criminal code and the controlled substances code and provides that, for the most part, they're almost all first-time violations would be petty misdemeanors for the next 2 years. And the list, you know, is there beginning on page 13 of the bill. Section 15 addresses the authority or, you know, clarifies that the locals have no authority to impose administrative penalties to enforce a criminal code provision or provision of any other state law that has a felony, gross misdemeanor, misdemeanor, or petty misdemeanor penalty. Section 16 temporarily, for 2 years again, suspends the application of the harassment restraining order law under 609.748. Now, it doesn't address the criminal penalty for harassment stalking, which is 609.749, but it would address the ability to get a restraining order and then a violation of it. Section 17 provides instructions to the revisers of statutes to basically make necessary technical changes to implement this article. Article 3, then, makes a number of changes to sentencing laws, felony DWI laws, and supervised release changes. Sections 1 to 5 and 23 address, currently there's a mandatory minimum sentence for repeat controlled substance offenders. And the mandatory minimums range from 4 years for first degree down to 6 months in local jail for fifth degree. These sections strike or repeal those mandatory minimums. And all the changes in this article are permanent. Beginning on Section 6, the felony DWI law is amended, currently applies to a person who commits a fourth DWI in 10 years. This would make it a fifth DWI in 10 years. Sections 7 to 9 and 11 are then conforming changes that relate to that change and the change that I'm about to talk about in Section 10. Section 10 amends the felony DWI law sentencing provision. In current law, a judge is required to impose a 3-year sentence of imprisonment on a person. The judge is not required to execute the sentence, but has to impose it. Also, there's current law that says the Commissioner of Corrections may not release a person from prison under the early release provision under the Challenge Incarceration Program, et cetera, unless the person has successfully completed a treatment program. This section would strike both of those requirements. That takes us up to Section 12. Section 12 repeals the mandatory minimum sentence applicable to predatory offender registration law violations. And then Sections 13 to 18, 20, and 21 amend laws that would state how long a person would spend in prison, the minimum term, both for the state and local levels. Currently, a person has to serve a minimum of 2/3 in prison or jail. This would make it 60%. Then Section 19 places a 90-day cap on the amount of time the Commissioner of Corrections can revoke a person who's on supervised release for a first-time violation at 90 days. This provision would not apply to sex offenders. And then Section 22 requests the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission to re-rank the felony DWI case offense at a lower level. Madam Chair, that is it.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Members, clarifying questions to Mr. Backus. Thank you very much, and that's the document.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, thank you for allowing us to put together this process to get the provisions that Senator Foley and I are looking at. We have, between the two of us, I think $122 million or something like that to cut from our two budgets. And we're, is that right? Some ugly number like that anyway. And we are turning over every rock we can think of that might have some savings. And we thank the committee for looking at these provisions, and I know we'll have the discussion next week, and we'll try to do our best with that. But we're really up against it with the numbers that we have been given.
Members, I had a long conversation with Senator Limmer yesterday, and it's unfortunate that he can't be here, but he's taking care of his family, which is a very good thing on a Saturday. And he is not opposed to the process that we've put in place. And, in fact, he was very supportive of the idea that it is the job of the policy committee to take a look at these policy provisions that has budget implications. So this is not trying to sneak anything in. We're trying to be transparent about how we're doing this. And Senator Limmer and I are both in agreement that this is the best possible way to move forward to meet all the deadlines and to give the best possible options to our budget chairs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I just want to take a moment to commend the chairs, all three of you, for doing this, because it does give the public more opportunity to review. Oftentimes, when you're talking about funding, it is a policy about how you raise sufficient funds to pay for the work that we do in our agencies or in our courts. And so I appreciate the fact that this is made public early on. People will have an even greater opportunity to read it, to become aware of it, and to comment. And so for that, I'm very grateful, and thank you.
Thank you, Senator Orman. Very good. All right, Senator Scheid. Members, you may recall that we took up the bill and we took testimony, and then we laid it on the table because Senator Scheid had to leave that day. But Senator Scheid, I wonder if you could take a couple of minutes to refresh our memory on the bill. And I know that we've got the summary in front of us, but maybe you could refresh our memory a little bit.
Madam Chair, yes, this bill, you may recall, has to do with lenders being required to come to mediation in the event of a foreclosure on a homesteaded property. And I talked about we had the farmer lender provision in since, I think, 1986, and this is kind of a natural follow-up to that that program. And frankly, members have in the last few years heard a variety of bills. Senator Higgins carried some significant legislation on predatory lending, and she and I both worked on other legislation in the last couple of years. We passed counseling. I don't know if you remember the bill from last year where we required counseling to be offered to people who were about to be foreclosed upon. And we still are looking for the stick, if you will, to get some lenders and or investors who want to foreclose to the table to work, to try to negotiate some kind of workout. You know, there are times when a homeowner cannot, and they just can't work. They've been long-term unemployed, whatever, and there's no way for them to work it out. But, well, Madam Chair, look who's come in. Bless his heart.
Well,
so we were just talking about you, Senator Limmer, earlier, and the chair was, in a very positive way.
Very complimentary, Senator Lemmer.
Now we know where his priorities are.
So, Madam Chair, this, we have heard this bill like we did all the others in the Commerce Committee before they have come to this committee. And the Commerce Committee, I think, liked that we're looking for a way to get more people to the table to try to work out some kind of a settlement, some kind of a way to go forward and keep people in their homes. The counseling is working for, in many cases, very successfully, and people are reaching some kind of an agreement with lenders, and people are staying in their homes. But counselors will tell us they still have trouble getting some parties to the table, meaning the lender, whoever is holding the mortgage. And we think I just learned of an editorial from the New York Times today. As you know, President Obama, about maybe a month ago now, announced a kind of a two-level program for helping people have their mortgages modified so that they could go forward. Some people going into foreclosure, some people not, but just kind of underwater where they owe more on the home than its value today. And apparently that's off to a slow start. And I'm going to quote here. The banks are still updating their systems to process applications for the relief and waiting clarification on a few points. Are those really unavoidable delays, or are they signs of resistance from the mortgage industry to modifying bad loans? When he unveiled the plan, Mr. Obama said he would support legislation to let bankrupt homeowners have their mortgages modified under court protection. The legislation would essentially tell lenders that unless they do the right thing and voluntarily rework loans, the process will be turned over to a bankruptcy judge. And this line in the editorial, I think, is really important. That stick is still missing. In other words, we know that it doesn't look like the carrots, if you will, of the TARP from last fall have really worked their way down to Main Street, if you will, and to real homeowners and to people who need to borrow, small businesses and whatever. Well, the House has passed the bankruptcy law. It's not going anyplace right now in the Senate. This editorial is encouraging the administration to move more strongly in that direction. We're obviously can't go to that degree, but we need a stick. We need something to get some parties to that table, and so that's what this bill does. And Kermit Fichte is here from the Attorney General's office. I can't recall, Madam Chair, if we went through the bill.
We did. We went through the bill. Yes. So we're just going to process it now. Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I have a couple of amendments, and Senator Limmer had an amendment that I think we ought to act on as well. That evening, I would just add a few words to it, but I think.
So let's take your amendments, and then we'll take Senator Limmer's amendment.
And Madam Chair, I think it's A12 and A13. Is this okay?
No, let's pass out the Limmer amendment to Ms. Pontius. Senator Limmer, do you know what your number your amendment is?
A7.
A7.
A7, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, in
Senator Ormond,
full disclosure, I have an amendment as well. It's the A16.
Okay. So, let's pass out those four. Because I'm assuming Senator Ormond wants to do hers.
I will, Madam Chair, make an offer and motion.
Thank you. Senator Shy, do you have your amendments?
Madam Chair, the A-12.
Okay.
Would. And I don't know that we discussed this. We did talk about this just kind of briefly in the Commerce Committee. Mr. Kevin Dunleavy raised some concerns about whether or not we would know how. It's very difficult to know what, whether a parcel is actually, a property is actually the homestead, the residence, the main residence, principal residence of the person who, you know, who is the debtor here. And so this would require, and he suggested affidavits. The Attorney General's office worked on language. I don't know, did Kermit, did you work on it? Christy Eilers worked on this language, and so what you have in the A-12 is just saying that there's going to be an affidavit required, and then the affidavit itself is actually
in the form.
Put in here. The form of the affidavit, yes, is.
Any questions for Senator Scheid on the A-12 amendment?
I'd move that amendment.
Anybody want to testify against the A-12 amendment? All right. Senator Scheid moves the A-12 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, on the A-13, these are further further language that the Attorney General's office and I talked about and worked out. What you have it's several subjects are covered here. Section 3 and 4 have to do with the redemption period. And what it says is it changes the redemption period from 5 to 6 months. I don't know. I can let Kermit tell you just technically that. Yeah, if you would. Why don't you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kermit Frichte with the Attorney General's office. The first part of the A-13 amendment changes the redemption period on homestead property from 6 months to 5 months for individuals who have undergone the mediation process and aren't able to successfully resolve the default. And the second portion of the amendment allows, there's been testimony that currently, mortgages are taking 12 to 18 months to foreclose in the state of Minnesota. And what the second part of the amendment says is the lender can process the foreclosure along up until the day before the 6-week publication notice is required. That's what that says.
Okay. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
There's more. Madam Chair, to the amendment.
Senator Scheid?
But did Senator Limmer have a question about that?
Senator Limmer, on that section?
Yeah, Madam Chair, shifting from 6 months to 5 months, could you tell me why that's necessary? What is the ultimate goal that you're trying to accomplish?
Senator Scheid?
Well, Madam Chair, I wasn't quite sure how this would work. We are concerned about the timeline of all of this, and it's very, very difficult to put the counseling and the mediation in and still maintain the process of when the notice of pendency, which is the first notice that you get a default letter, but then you get the notice of pendency, and you find out that they're going to begin foreclosure proceedings, and then let me get the and so the timeline gets stretched out when you have the counseling required before you go to mediation, the counseling which we did last year. And I think it can really complement the mediation and get people better prepared for mediation. And some people will find out that they can't go anyplace with this. And others will maybe get things worked out or negotiated satisfactorily. But in any case, they still have the right to mediation, but they must do the counseling. So I think that will kind of funnel people in. It won't be, the counselor isn't going to say you can't do mediation. It's not set up like that, but it funnels people into it. And so you end up with a time frame that stretches out where, frankly, it looks to, I mean, some people from the banking industry told me that, I mean, it could take this out almost to 2 years. I mean, if you took you know.
Well, Madam Chair, the question I'm bringing up is if the homeowner realizes, even despite the counseling, that they just don't see that's in their future and they want to step away from the process and just let the property go, is there a problem with going even that five-month period? Could they sign off and release their interest prior to the 5 months?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I believe so, but Mr. Frichti can clarify.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, under the current law, there is a provision where someone can voluntarily agree to shorten the mediation period, the redemption period. And there's also a means by which, if the property is abandoned, the lender can file an action in court after the sheriff's sale to shorten it down to 5 weeks.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Scheid. I understand what you're concerned about, because the foreclosure sale gets delayed if there is additional counseling and if there's mediation, and then the lender's interest gets delayed that much further because there right now technically still a 6 month redemption period added on top of whatever length of time it took to get through counseling and mediation, which is added incentive and disincentive to do the mediation if then you still have the 6 month period after that. I understand what you're trying to accomplish with this amendment. The concern I have is the internal consistency, because now we have two different standards. Those that go through mediation are a 5 month redemption period. Those that haven't been through are still a 6 month, and we're having such a hard time educating borrowers and tenants about what their rights are, and now we've got two different classes of redemption periods, and so I'm concerned about that. I hope you can address that, because I get what you're trying to accomplish here, and I see why it seems fair to then shorten that length of time because of the delay. But I am concerned about complicating things, and then the message that gets out to the public is confused again. Is it 5 months or is it 6 months? And that's one of the things that the public is pretty aware of, is that 6 month redemption period.
Senator Scheid.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I don't know how many redemptions are actually accomplished. I think it's maybe count on one hand or two. I don't know. But that's not today with the number of foreclosures. I just don't think that's happening very much. You know, there's a whole lot to be said for us looking at that six-month redemption period in any case, and I know you have thoughts about how we extend the reinstatement time frame, which I think is, a worthy proposal as well, and I think the subject of your amendment. But this was an effort. If you've gone through mediation and you still can't work that out, I mean, it's possible, I think, some people have suggested it even at that point, that maybe, you do have the option to waive your right to go through that period under current law. So I'm guessing that some people do that. And it's just a matter of, I don't think that there's a whole lot of awareness of the redemption period, frankly, among the general public, certainly among people who are facing foreclosure, I guess, although I'm not sure that everybody understands even what that means,
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
One of the big issues in the foreclosure process right now are those notifications to those affected. They're complicated. They're full of legalese. And now that's just my concern, is that when that notice goes out, we now have to have these folks understand whether they were through mediation, they weren't through mediation, and they have to figure out whether they've got a five-month window now or a six-month window now. And I appreciate what you're doing, and I really like your bill. I'm just a little concerned about that, and so I hope that you'll give some thought to that.
Good.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
And Madam Chair, this bill does have to go to finance, and I don't want to say that we shouldn't do the work here. It just is one of those issues that's going to take a lot of, give and take and conversation along the way. But I will. I want to say, I guess, that the timeline is still an outstanding issue in a way. There's still some things that need to be refined, I think, to improve it. So I'll take that certainly into consideration. Then, Madam Chair, on the amendment, if I may, after, down at line 16,
There is language in the bill right now that was added in the Commerce Committee, and it had to do with mortgages that would be refinanced or modified under this plan that I actually discussed or mentioned when I was reading from the New York Times editorial on it's the Home Affordable Refinance Program. I said there were two programs the president had announced. That was one, and then HAMP, the Home Affordable Modification Programs. And those were two that the two programs that are out there now. And if a loan has been modified already by that, then those people would not be going through mediation. They would have already had their loan modified.
Okay.
Now, in the Commerce Committee, we also, there was a paragraph B, and I should be giving you the actual, I guess it's on page 5. So you can look at that language on 5.9 through 5.11. Well, I guess I'm looking at, is this, am I doing the right thing here? Okay. That we, I know, we are rewriting actually sub 3, their applicability. You can see that that's shortened down to 3 lines from the, like, the four and a part of a line on 5.8. And then the B, paragraph, parens B, we're just taking that out. And I'm hoping that this is the right. Yeah, we're just deleting subdivision 3. I'm sorry. So we're deleting that whole subdivision, which is paragraph A and B, and we will just have the paragraph that you see on lines 117, 119 of the, I'm sorry, I got confused, of the amendment. So because we had a few more programs listed in there which didn't have much to do with modified loans. And then B said that, and this was language that the credit unions and the community bankers wanted. And I wasn't keen on the 38% because that's kind of the standard loan-to-value ratio that, you know, I think good lenders are using or should use. And the federal program talks about getting down to taking 38 and then going down to 31, I think, with the additional that dollar discrepancy or disparity being made up by the feds. I think that's how that program would work under Obama's plan. I will tell you that I'm still concerned, you know, about our community banks and our credit unions. I don't think they have, I don't know the percentages of loans that are in foreclosure. I know that their standards are pretty high, and many of them hold their own mortgages. Some don't, and even if we had testimony in Commerce that even if they do hold, they, even if they sell the mortgage, they do the servicing for it, and there are people that, you know, in the community, people that they know in everyday life, and that they feel that they really would be unduly burdened by this. My comment to that, my response to that is, if you're not having that many foreclosures and you're working with people, you probably won't be very negatively affected by this. They would make an argument that, well, it will affect the availability of credit, and I think that that horse has left the barn, you know, in terms of that argument, in terms of credit and the availability. So I don't know if anybody's going to testify. I mean, Mr. Skillbred wanted me to keep this in here as a placeholder. I will just say to you that I'm still open to some kind of language that might work better for the community bankers, but this doesn't do it. And I don't want to just outright exempt community banks and credit unions, but there may be some kind of criteria you could put to the language other than just what you see on paragraph B. So that's what that is. And then maybe Mr. Frichte would talk about, let's see, page 6, line 1, 1.20. Okay, that's still. Okay, that's about continuing the foreclosure process. Maybe you can speak to the technical piece.
Ms. Frichte?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the language that starts at line 20 talks about continuing allowing the foreclosure process to continue up until the day before the six-week publication notice is given, and that's it's referenced two times in the bill, once in the notice that's provided to the borrower, and then again later on as reflected on line 26 of the bill that talks about what the effect of the notice is, and I think that's what I referenced earlier on in my comments.
Okay. Senator Scheid, is that the amendment, the entire amendment?
And
yes.
Then, yes, yes.
Any other questions to Senator Scheid on the A13 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lindmar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 10, the amendment, there's a reference to this subdivision expiring on December 31st. The legislature won't be in session at that date, and I may suggest that we might push the date into the next legislative session so that if we wanted to extend that date, we would be here at that time. I don't know, maybe a date like February 15th may give plenty of time for consideration by the legislature if they needed to extend that date.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, we have other references to that date through the bill. I mean, it's possible members could decide to change that date. It would have to be changed, you know, in all of its
Ms. Pontius,
bill.
December 31st seems like it's a specific date that might be tied to something else.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Scheid indicated the whole program sunsets December 31st, 2014. Okay. So that's why anything that is tied just to this program is also sunsetted. So obviously it would have to be during the 2013 session if the legislature wanted to do anything. It would have to extend the whole program.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might, I believe, for example, the Farmer Lender program expires maybe this summer sometime.
July 1st.
Yeah, after the session is over. So it's the kind of thing that you do need to take care of if you needed to extend it. Well, I know we've extended that more than once, I think.
Senator Higgins.
Thinking is obviously that we aren't going to have the numbers of, you know, the hope and the prayer is that we're not going to have the numbers of foreclosures at that point. In this
Madam Chair, I certainly hope we're through this financial mess in 5 years, but you talk to different economists and some are saying by the end of this year, and I think that's kind of laughable, but on the other hand, 5 years isn't the norm either, so some are saying it's extended beyond that. I just thought that it might be convenient if we're going to expire anything that it would be during the time the legislature might be in session that they might be able to react rather than having some gaps in time for the person that's might be in dire need of a program like this. I would hate to have them lose their house, let's say, because they missed it. We don't cover for 1 or 2 months. So,
Senator Lindmar, I'm sure people in the industry are paying attention to that date, and certainly I think in the legislative session in 2013, if we need to.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not too concerned about the attention given by the industry. I'm concerned about the attention given by the consumer. And I think the consumer isn't going to be circling December 31st on their calendar 5 years out. So I just thought since we're sometimes the advocate of the consumer, it would be nice to be in office at the time this expires, that if we had to extend the sunset, we'd be here to do that. But I'll...
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I really do sincerely believe that this bill is about helping consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we'll take that into consideration. I do think that the Attorney General's office, who would be responsible for managing this program, and legislators will be, you know, plugged in. I don't know, you know, if you or I will be here, probably. You know.
He'll be here.
So, you know, I think it's the kind of thing that will be brought to our attention.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, on the A13 amendment, the head note on line 12 just struck me as a little strange. And I'm wondering, I think I will move to amend, to delete the head note as written on the amendment and insert no deficiency judgment.
Repeat that.
No deficiency judgment.
With room 6, 5, 5, 8.
Senator Scheid.
And Madam Chair, you can see it comes right out of current law. And I'm not looking at subdivision 1 of 582.0, but it strikes me, and perhaps Ms. Pontius can tell us if that works. It's that is not a really artful phrase, I dare say.
That's a nice way to say it. And so what I have is more artful
phrase. If it doesn't cause any distress on 582.30, you could see the context of it. I don't know.
Let me go get them.
Oh, yeah, that's weird.
Senator Higgins' suggestion will be incorporated into the 813 amendment.
And Madam Chair, what will it say? I'm sorry.
No deficiency judgment. Any further discussions from members on the 813 amendment? Anybody in the audience would like to the 813 amendment? Anybody in the audience would like to testify on the 813?
Okay, here we go.
Mr. Skilbred, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. David Skilbred, Vice President of Government Relations with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. If I could just speak to the 813, line 1.16, that deletes subdivision 3 and then inserts a substitute paragraph for what now is paragraph A. First of all, I want to thank Senator Scheid for the commitment to work on paragraph B, and I know that we will continue to work on that as well as many other pieces in this bill. Like all bills, they're never perfect right out of the chute, and that's why we have this process and both bodies to improve it. We've improved many of the sections of this bill. I would ask today, however, that members keep paragraph B in there. I recognize it's not perfect. I will commit to continue to working with Senator Scheid to improve that and other parties. It was clear, though, that the Commerce Committee thought that it was appropriate for some sort of exclusion for those banks that are not participating in the Obama foreclosure mitigation plan, but yet working and complying to the spirit of that plan. And that's what we're trying to get at in paragraph B. Secondly, just to remind the members, the reason that we used the 38% threshold was because we were trying to parallel the conformity and compliance provisions of paragraph A. And as Senator Scheid said, in those proceedings and the working that is done in the Obama foreclosure mitigation plan, banks write down the mortgage down to that 38% using their own resources, and then together on a dollar-for-dollar match, write it down to the 31%. So the reason we chose that was, number one, it paralleled paragraph A, and number two, it recognized that banks in paragraph B do not get the federal assistance, and therefore the standard, which is measurable at least, was such that it was equal to what the other banks in paragraph A would do on their own. So that's the rationale, and again, we'll continue to work with all the parties on this, and we would just ask you that you keep paragraph B in the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Witt. I'm CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I wanted to speak to the same provision as well. I want to thank the author for working with us to try and address the scope of this bill. As you all know very well, all the bills that come before you are there for a certain reason. There is a purpose behind it. And the purpose of this bill, as stated by the author, is that we need to get certain lenders to the table who are not able to get to the table through the counseling process. In the Commerce Committee, we worked hard to distinguish ourselves from the lenders that are not showing up. The Minnesota banks, the Minnesota credit unions that have a presence here are not difficult to get a hold of, and they're not difficult to find. And that's why we were so pleased to see the Commerce Department put a placeholder in, and again, even if it wasn't perfect language, to at least put a placeholder in to acknowledge that the Minnesota financial institutions are not the ones that are the problems here. There was testimony of servicers that were located in California, and people would call the servicer and try and get some assistance, and they'd be forwarded through an email or a telephone system and eventually cut off, and they didn't get any satisfaction. On the other hand, the testimony from the counseling groups is that the Minnesota organizations are not the problem and that they are cooperating well. And for that reason, we were pleased to see that the Commerce Committee did add that amendment. We have committed to working with Senator Scheid to make sure that we narrow the scope appropriately, but I too would speak in favor of keeping that placeholder in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witnesses? Any further testimonies on the 813 amendment? Senator Scheid has Senator Scheid moves the 813 amendment. All those in favor of the 813 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Let's take Senator Lummer, your A7.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The members might remember that I introduced this bill briefly at the end of our discussion earlier this week, and Senator Scheid was given an opportunity to review it. We haven't talked since that time, and I believe she has some added words that she may want to alter this amendment with, but I don't know what that is. So.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I think even as maybe, I don't know if Senator Lummer heard me say that I referenced his amendment and said that I just had a few words to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the A7 amendment,
right.
Which is the one you introduced the other evening, if I'm
That's
not
right.
mistaken. And Madam Chair, at the beginning of the new language there on line 1.2, I would just say, I would add, at the discretion of the mediator. I don't know if it needs a comma, but at the discretion of the mediator, mediation meetings may be held.
That's it. Senator Scheid, Senator Lummer, do you want that to be a formal motion, or would you like to just incorporate that into the A7?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd just like to chat about it a little bit so we understand. If, let's say, one of the other parties, primarily the consumer, couldn't come to the meeting, would the mediator be able to trump that concern and demand the presence of the consumer at that meeting? Let's say they were disabled or there was a blizzard in this scheduled time. I don't know how time critical this particular mediation would be unless it was butting up against a deadline, but would the mediator be able to trump an obvious issue like that of the consumer?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I think yes, but I think that that's kind of the idea here. I think that I'm concerned about if we just say that they may be done that way, that doesn't necessarily say they shall or will.
Yeah.
They may be, somebody has to be able to make that decision. And mediation is a very reasonable kind of process in one, you know,
That's right.
at one level, and I think it makes sense to let the mediator decide, because I'm thinking of a situation where if you have a certain lender, a certain servicer, whomever, that won't come to the table, that you can't, you're having trouble getting there, and after the first time when they just say, well, we don't have to, you know?
Yeah.
There's something about sitting in that room with the mediator, I think, that is beneficial to the whole process. But I understand the situation that could arise where one or the other party, maybe even the mediator, couldn't get there. But
Madam Chair, I think Senator Scheid makes a good point. We also wouldn't want this option to be the norm or the default for mediation, that it just everything shifts to a telephone call. I think there is an importance to the value of having a face-to-face meeting with all parties. So I would accept the language of after the word insert on line 2 to insert at discretion of mediator, comma.
So Senator Scheid, Senator Limmer is going to incorporate
the discretion of the mediator.
Yep, at the discretion. So Senator Limmer will incorporate that into the A7 amendment.
And Madam Chair, then I certainly subscribe.
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Limmer moves the A7 amendment. Anybody in the audience wish to testify against this amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Ortman, the A16.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You'll recall last year I had introduced a bill to provide Minnesota homeowners an additional remedy available to them when their home mortgage is in default prior to the end of the redemption period. Right now, Minnesota law is insufficient, I believe. We don't have enough remedies for homeowners. If you are late in your mortgage, and you get to be sufficiently late to be in default, you never have a remedy but to go out and find new financing and buy up the loan with a different lender. That's the only option Minnesota homeowners have, short of mediation and counseling if Senator Scheid passes her bill, and I think that's great. But it's the whole shebang. It's all or nothing for Minnesota homeowners, and they can't exercise this right of redemption. As you know, I work in the sheriff's office in Hennepin County. Last year, we had 7,300 foreclosures. We had about 350 redemptions. As the number of foreclosures go up, the number of redemptions have gone down. Minnesotans don't really have a remedy, a realistic remedy, because if they're late, they're already a bad credit risk. The credit has been tightening. And so it's harder and harder for Minnesota homeowners to find an option. So the bill that I introduced in the A16 amendment clarifies that there is another option, and that would be reinstatement. Reinstatement would allow Minnesota homeowners, if they're in default, to have as an additional remedy under our law the ability to come current, meaning if you're 3 months behind, you can make 3 months of payment, and you have the right to stay in your home. The interest and penalties and late fees would be rolled onto the back of the loan, so you still are responsible. You could only do it one time under the provision, Senator Limmer, and I thought that was a really good question. Can you do this again and again and again? The answer is no. One time. A Minnesota homeowner, if they get behind in their loan, they end up defaulting on the mortgage, they have the right to borrow, to go into their 401k, to have a family member help them to come current, and then they can continue in the loan, and the lender would not be able to object. It would be a right under Minnesota law. It's a far better alternative than asking our bankruptcy courts to modify our contracts, because there are some constitutional questions when we allow someone to rewrite a contract in a bankruptcy court or anywhere else. I think that the Minnesota legislature, it's up to us to determine what remedies are. We've determined what the remedy should be for the banks. They can foreclose, and they do. The only option we have available for homeowners is redemption, and as I've said, it's not a very realistic option for homeowners because they can't get the credit, they're already late, they're a bad credit risk, and they have to be able to pay all the penalties up front, all the fees up front, all of the late fees and the interest, and get the whole mortgage bought out by a subsequent banker. And in this economy, it's not going to happen. It's not happening. So over the last 5 years, if you look at the charts of the experience in Hennepin County, which is similar to everywhere else, the numbers of foreclosures have skyrocketed. The numbers of redemptions have plummeted. that's the experience. And it's because we don't have an intermediate remedy for Minnesotans. And I think this is the intermediate remedy that we should be talking about. It's let them come current and stay in their home. I would make one other point. We had a large wave of foreclosures. Many were because there were investment-owned properties. We've dealt with most of those. And this amendment would only allow for resident owners, if you're in resident on the premises. So the remedy is not available to investment owners that aren't present living on the property. But we had the first wave. Many of them were investment-owned. Some of them were residential owners. But the second wave is coming. All of those folks that are facing unemployment, that are currently unemployed, they're missing their payments. In December of 2008, 6% of all Minnesota mortgages were late. 6% of all mortgage owners were late. And so as unemployment goes up, we're up to 8.2% now, 8.2% up on the Iron Range. It's 10%. People are unemployed. They're not able to make their home payments. And so if they can find some way to come current, I think Minnesota law should allow them to stay in their home, and the banks should be willing to work with them if they can come current, short of paying all those interest and penalties. And they'll make the commitment to pay those interest and penalties and fees for this one-time occurrence at the end of the loan. They're no less responsible as they would be. They just ask that it be put aside until at the end of the payoff period. And I hope members will help me accomplish this purpose.
So, thank you, Senator Scheid.
Senator Ortman,
I'm sorry.
It's a compliment, though. Thank you.
I'm working on a Saturday.
I'll call you Madam Chair. I mean, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A-16
all right.
amendment.
Thank you. So moved.
I think Senator Foley.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank
Correct.
You, Senator Orton, for your excellent legislative proposal, and I support you. One of the things that would be very nice to look at, have something additional that would help the individuals get to the stage that you're talking about. By the time they're in the process, most of it, I would think, would be too late.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
on
Wartman.
This remedy would be available all the way up through the redemption period. So any time from the start until they actually have to leave the premises, they can find the funds to come current and stay in their home.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Senator Ortman as well. I think we need to figure out every tool that we can possibly give somebody to stay in their homes. It helps not only the family, but it helps the community when those houses are filled with families who are part of the community rather than when they're empty and then they get broken into and then the decline really starts. And, I think as Senator Moi said earlier when we were looking at the committee amendment that Senator Foley and I are working on, these are extraordinary times, and maybe in another time, in another place, we wouldn't need such a remedy. But I think that this is a good thing to add to the work that Senator Scheid is doing and getting people another option that may work for them.
Senator Ortman, I had a question. What would prevent a person that may be facing foreclosure? They're already given a foreclosure period. Is there anything that would prevent them from pursuing the types of satisfaction that you spell out here in the redemption period rather than extending the time period further out? Is that what your amendment does?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't extend the time period at all. It just allows them a remedy short of full redemption, which is going to get the whole mortgage refinanced, plus rolling in all their late fees and all the penalties and the interest. I mean, they've got to go and find a banker that will loan them more than the loan that they just defaulted on, and that's why I'm saying it's not a very realistic remedy. And, Mr. Chair, if I could say to all the bankers that I know have concerns about this, if a Minnesota homeowner finds a way to go borrow the money or take it out of their 401k to reinvest, to take make use of this remedy, they're going to be a better credit risk after that because they will have then again reinvested in their home, obviously with the intent to continue paying and stay current. They have that much more interest. If they wanted to walk away, they could walk away, and they still get the full redemption period. They can stay there as long as they want. But this way, they are reinvesting, and by accepting this money, you're going to find a renewed commitment on the part of the homeowners to stay in their home and make their payments because it is a one-time remedy.
Senator Scheid.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I'm very familiar with this language. I mean, Senator Ortman did mention to me last week, I think, that she wanted to do this, and while I'm not doing cartwheels over having it added to this bill, I think it is something we should look at, and it needs some work. Mr. Frickty and I are talking about it needs to be worked into what we have, and so I'm not going to oppose it. I'll vote to put it in, but with the understanding that it needs to be kind of networked into what we have here already, because some of the language is current law about the counseling and the notice to, and we've done some changes to that. And this would be for the people that are going to get foreclosed upon. And I wanted to just verify, and I think that on page 4 it does, if they've been reinstated, they can't keep doing this. Is that right, Senator Ortman? This is a one-time deal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I think that's very clear in here. It's on line 1.27 and 2.8 in the notice to the homeowner. It says, unless you previously reinstated your mortgage. And I think it's in there again, but that is definitely my intention, that it should be a one-time opportunity to come current on your mortgage.
And, Mr. Chairman, yeah, it says paragraph B doesn't apply if the mortgage being foreclosed previously has been reinstated. So, yeah, I was pretty sure that's what you meant there.
Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to speak for or against this amendment? Could you please identify yourself for the record?
I'm Kevin Dunleavy. I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association.
Mr. Dunleavy?
Yes, Dunleavy. I met with Senator Ortman and along with a number of other attorneys about this bill last year. And the problems that the bill had last year are still in the bill. The concept is unworkable. It would essentially destroy the foreclosure process in Minnesota because right now Minnesota has a relatively simple foreclosure process where there's a reinstatement period, there's a sheriff's sale, and then there's a redemption period. Those are two separate and distinct concepts. The reinstatement is you bring it current. Redemption is you pay it off. By mixing the two concepts, the process will probably not be workable anymore. It'll create title problems for every property that's foreclosed because, well, the bill itself, it's inherently contradictory. At one place it says the sheriff's certificate has to be recorded in 20 days, and another place it says it has to be recorded at the end of the redemption period. Assuming that the redemption period, at the end of the redemption period, is when it gets recorded, what will happen is the debtors will file bankruptcy because the sheriff's certificate isn't recorded. And that means by the time the bankruptcy is over and the foreclosure process is started again, that's a year delay. A foreclosure by advertisement takes about 10 months start to finish. A bankruptcy takes, regular consumer bankruptcy is about 3 months. So there's been a 10-month process. The sheriff's certificate is recorded till the end. There's a bankruptcy. That will mean another year. So the foreclosure process now more than doubles. Federal tax liens and state tax liens will be difficult or impossible to eliminate state and federal tax liens on property because the sheriff's certificate has to be recorded. It has to be noticed to the creditor under both state and federal law. Any tax lien that's recorded 30 days before the sheriff's sale has to be given 20 days notice. The IRS then has the longer of the state law redemption period or 120 days to redeem. I don't know what happens with this when the sheriff's certificate's not recorded till the end. where the sale is annulled. I don't know if this will wipe out junior tax liens. It also prejudices the rights of junior creditors. Under the present system, and the Supreme Court has said that redemption is good for everybody. If a junior creditor redeems, that means more of the debts are paid by the property. That's good for the junior creditors. It's good for society in general if the debts are paid. Under this process, junior creditors won't be able to tell if there's been a foreclosure because the sheriff's certificate is not recorded till the end. They won't be able to protect their rights. So essentially, all junior creditors will lose their rights. What this will do is blur the process and probably make it unworkable because of the blurring of this what's presently two separate and distinct rights. As a practical matter, it's unlikely that the debtor is going to be able to reinstate at the end of the redemption period if they couldn't reinstate before the sheriff's sale. Typically what happens is they're not making the payments. They fail to pay. If they can bring it current before the sheriff's sale, that's the best thing. That cures the default. That's the best thing. There's no foreclosure then. But if you have someone that's unemployed and they can't make the payments before the sheriff's sale, it's extremely unlikely that they're going to be able to make them during a 6-month redemption period. So the practicality of increasing reinstatements by basically goofing up the law isn't really going to result in a lot of positive good, unfortunately.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Anyone else? Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Witt with the Minnesota Bankers Association, and I too want to thank Senator Ortman. We had a chance to talk with her last year, and I think we agree with her concept that if the redemption period does not provide a meaningful relief for consumers, is there some way that we can change the remedy so that there is a better remedy for consumers out there, that we can keep more people in their homes? We definitely agree with that concept, and we support that. However, we too think that this particular amendment, because of the fact that it does change up the rights and remedies with respect to reinstatement versus redemption, causes some trouble. And I would also take a little bit of exception to what the senator said, in that there is a pretty significant time period where the consumer does have an opportunity to bring their loan current. To say that consumers have no opportunity, I think, is maybe overstating it. In your package of materials, I think I believe we put a chart in like this, a color-coded chart in your packet. And if you don't have that, I do have some additional copies. But if you have that chart, if you could maybe just take a quick look at it. This outlines what is a typical foreclosure process here in Minnesota, with some time frames, and also lists out when different sorts of things happen. Not sure if there's a page that could help me out. As you look at this chart, the sheriff sale on this chart happens at roughly 240 days in the process. And as Mr. Dunleavy just said, the reinstatement period allows them to bring their loan current any time before that sheriff sale. So they have the entire period from their first late payment all the way up until the sheriff sale, which is typically 240 days, to bring that loan current under current law. The reason that we're concerned about it is, if you've already had the sheriff sale, somebody else owns the property at that time. To give them the right of reinstatement after that time, where they're not paying off the entire debt, but they're just paying a portion of the debt to bring it current, somebody else could potentially own that property, yet the borrower still has their original reinstatement right. That's why we had the concern. And I know, too, Senators, we had talked a little bit about some of the time frames that are in this bill. And I guess part of our reason for including this chart was that if you did have any questions about the impact that the bill overall has on some of these time frames, we would very much like the opportunity to talk about some of the things that we think this bill does to these timeframes. And I don't know if during this amendment is the right time to bring that up, but I would like to just say that was part of the reason why we did include this chart. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Further discussion? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not surprised by the comments from the bankers. The amendment is perfectly workable. I think when we hear that it's not workable, I think you should read that to mean undesirable. Of course it's undesirable on the part of the bankers to offer another remedy to our homeowners. But as unlikely as it might be that a homeowner might be able to come current, it's no less unlikely than their ability to redeem, which essentially doesn't exist. When Hennepin County saw 750 mortgage sales in 1 month, we saw 11 redemptions 6 months later. 11 out of 750, that's not a very realistic remedy. And of that, many were exercised by junior creditors, not by the owners themselves because they weren't able to get the credit that they needed. A couple of specifics about bankruptcy in particular. I'm sure the bankruptcy judges can manage this. When it comes to the redemption process, it was very complicated when it was first adopted as a remedy, and the courts developed case law to interpret our intention with the remedy. They'll do the same thing with reinstatement. I would point out on page 2, where it says a certificate, section B at lines 2.10, a certificate of sale must not be recorded until after expiration of the redemption and reinstatement period. There's language to address one of those concerns right in the bill. Page 3 at subdivision, section 5, subdivision 2, section 3.18, it talks about, I guess, 3.20, the mortgage retains the priority it had at the time of the sale with respect to other liens and encumbrances on the property, whether created or perfected before or after the sale. So I think it's unfortunate that folks who are averse to the concept of a new remedy are trying to point out difficulties in the bill that just don't exist or can be workable. I think it is workable. The reason it is a little bit complicated is the redemption and the foreclosure law currently is very simple. Unfortunately, too simple. It is very simple for a bank or a lender to take a mortgage and put it in foreclosure. Way too simple. Send a notice, and the homeowner's in the foreclosure process and can't get out. And please don't underestimate the number of interest payments, penalties, fees, and costs that get added on. That's what we're trying to help the homeowners out of, is to say it doesn't just keep piling on. If you can make your mortgage payment and you can come current, you should be able to have one more chance at staying in your home. And as I said, they'll become even better credit risks beyond that because they would have drawn their savings. They would have borrowed from friends or parents. They would have borrowed against their pensions and their 401ks to stay in their home if they're going to make use of this process. They will be reinvesting in their home and recommitting to that loan and to the lender when they do it. And I would hope that the bankers would work with me to see if we can't work through some of the other issues that remain before this committee or this bill hopefully moves on to the next committee. I think the Commerce Committee, Senator Scheid.
It's been to Commerce.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking for the gavel. thank you. Chairman, and it will... Senator Ortman, it will go to finance. It's been to Commerce.
Finance. Thank you.
Senator Betzold.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. And I don't think it's just the bankers who have some concerns. Mr. Dunleavy pointed out a couple of things, too. The laws that we have on the books for foreclosure have been around for quite a while, but it's been my understanding that they are mainly there to help protect the owner of the property, the homeowner, from losing it. There's a lot of things that have to be done before you finally get to that point. I think that, you know, we've had a lot of foreclosures here, and it's really terrible, but I think in many cases it's because there's sort of a downward spiral that the people are in that I don't know that they can pull themselves out of it, and that's why, you know, they lose their property. So I don't know if this is going to solve it or whether it's going to delay the inevitable, but you know, there's a lot of things I do think that Senator Ortman has in here that, you know, seem a very good idea, but I think that, but I do take Mr. Dunleavy's comments quite seriously that, boy, this could change, you know, the well-established procedures that we have in here. So, thank you.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I said before I would support it. I'm concerned as well. I know that you worked with Mr. Dunleavy and you had probably more than one meeting last year over this. Senator Ortman, it has issues just because it needs to work with the changes we're making in the bill I'm offering. So that needs to be worked out. And I think that the issues, the timeline issue that Mr. Witt raises and the other legal issues about title and reporting and interests of junior creditors, that sort of thing, that's not an area of my expertise by any means at that point. And so I'm a little afraid that it might bog my bill down in a way that I don't want to have to deal with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, this is a policy committee, and with that, I would ask that this committee support this as a policy. We either can or we can't work through some of the particularities here. I'm willing to work with Mr. Dunleavy again. Hopefully he won't be just adamantly opposed, but will offer creative solutions and find ways to help me work through his objections to the process. I think it can be done if he's willing. Senator Scheid, I hope that you would allow this to go on as a policy point, that this committee thinks there should be another remedy. I myself will support your taking it out if it bogs down your bill. I don't want to do that. But I'd really appreciate this committee taking a vote in support of this as a policy, that we would like to see another remedy for homeowners in Minnesota, and that there should be something short of redemption. We can send a strong message to the lenders today by saying the Judiciary Committee in the Minnesota State Senate wants you to look for another avenue for homeowners to help them so that we don't see them all out of their homes. If redemption isn't working, let's look for something else. And I think you can send a message to the bankers and lenders here and the lawyers to say, let's work on something else. And I would appreciate that. And Senator Scheid, you have my word that if this complicates your bill, it'll be out. I'll support you taking it out later.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate
Senator Scheid.
That.
Senator Foley?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I fully support what you're trying to do here. I think that it's a very necessary step to deal with someone that can't deal with the issue today. And so I would move this or ask that the bill go forward, or amendment go forward.
Any further discussion? All those in favor of Senator Ortman's A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye. A16, Mr. Chair. Oh. The A16 amendment.
Was yours.
Oh, the A16. I'm
that
sorry.
The other one was way worse.
Oh, that's why we had a lot of discussion
that was
on this
my,
stuff.
there was no other one. I'm just kidding.
Wow. To rephrase that, the A16 amendment is Senator Ortman's. All those in favor of including the A16 Senator Scheid's bill, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Amendment passes.
Thank you, members.
Any other amendments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the bill as amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Finance. We'll continue to work, obviously, with Senator Ortman's amendment and any other. The timeline is a concern, and I think I saw that Ms. Berger was here from the realtors. They're concerned about how this would be funded. I also am concerned about that and want to, you know, I'll keep working with them. The credit unions and community bankers and also the Minnesota bankers have a concern about things that banks might be doing that aren't even eligible for the federal modification programs. I'll keep talking to them, but I think that we're going in the right direction here.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak further on the Senate File 340 as amended? Hearing none, Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 340 as amendment be recommended to pass and move to the Senate Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes.
Chairman, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Shild, Senate File 1310. Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1310. And there are some people here who will come up and join me.
No fault.
I think when people may have heard that Senator Shide was offering a bill for some no-fault reform,
oh, you mean the bill.
It may have harkened them back to, I think, 2005. I had legislation that made some really deep changes, profound changes in how the system works. I did not get real far and have decided, and I haven't carried anything in the interim, in the meantime, for these 4 years, but this bill raises some issues that we've heard about in that ensuing time and makes some small changes, I think, that are pro-consumer. Consumer meaning even the person who, the victim, for example, in an accident, the consumer who's paying insurance premiums, and also certainly with sections, I have to figure out, with sections 2 and 3 of the bill, which are benefit increases. That's certainly consumer-friendly. So I would like to present the bill. This bill has also been to the Commerce Committee that dealt really primarily with sections 2 and 3 and kind of the balancing of provisions, but didn't look in great detail at the technical pieces that would be more properly dealt with in the Judiciary Committee. But I want to draw your attention. The focus of this bill is on the medical costs and the no-fault auto law, but it does not, for example, do what I did earlier 4 years ago, which was require a managed care system equal to the workers' comp law. I had sought to do that before. This in no way does that. So these are really, I think, a real well-balanced bill that I think is, at the bottom line, very pro-consumer. It's very balanced, and the reform I get in here that I am offering in here is very targeted. But Section 2 and 3, Section 2 increases the maximum weekly wage loss benefit from $250 a week to $500 a week. It doesn't change the overall $20,000 cap under the no-fault, but it allows for a more reasonable dollar amount within that the time frame of when, or within the period of when people are not able to work. So it takes that up to $500 a week. And then Section 3 takes the funeral and burial expense coverage from $2,000 up to $5,000, which is also, I think, a responsible and reasonable reflection of what costs are. So then these are balanced. These two pieces are balanced, I think, with some targeted reforms that look at problems that I see, I believe, exist in the current law and add unnecessary costs. At the end of the day, you're not going to see premiums come way down. You're not going to see lawsuits go way up. This is just kind of a balanced provision, the small changes. Now, sections 1, 4, 5, 9, and 10, I think, are probably within the purview of the Judiciary Committee. You know, an individual that's hurt in an accident today gets health care treatment, in an auto accident, gets health care treatment wherever they want. If the health care is done at a hospital or from a doctor or a provider who has a contract with a managed care plan, then that provider receives that the plan's negotiated rate. The people are not billed for the difference. These sections of the bill recognize that that negotiated rate is the medical expense that's needed to treat the individual. Today, the individual is able to claim what's called the rack rate. In other words, when you look at your EOB and you see that, in my case, a chemotherapy treatment was $11,000. But the discounted rate that was paid by my health plan was substantially less. It may have been, you know, $2,400. The amount actually paid is the $2,400, and I think that that made my bill paid in full. I was not billed for the difference. So in a matter of a personal injury case, what's happened with some court decisions is that the victim is allowed to get that differential. So if, for example, the medical costs were $60,000, but the insurance plan paid whatever the negotiated rate was with the provider, say $15,000. Today, under a number of decisions, the victim has been able to get that $45,000, and I contend that that's a windfall and not part of the medical expense, what is actually paid. And so that's what this is. And if we can prevent those windfalls, you have some savings in the system. And I think that's probably maybe the most contentious piece of the bill. I'm not sure of that, but that's what I'm trying to do there. And then Section 6 says if there's credible evidence of fraud, Madam Chair, I'm going to offer to take that out because that of the bill, just that Section 6, and then I'll go on, and then we can come back maybe to do that. I think that's the only section that refers to that. Section 7 just doesn't allow balanced billing by health care providers after an arbitrator has decided what payment should be made for the medical services that have been provided. What's happened is that individual consumers then get billed for whatever wasn't awarded, for services that weren't awarded in that arbitrator's decision. So where they may have been determined to be excessive or unnecessary or unreasonable. And then, so this has nothing to do, of course, with the insurance company. This has to do with the fact that consumers get billed for what the arbitrator has said wasn't necessary care. So there's that. That's the balanced billing provision. And then I think something that the Commerce Committee really did like, Section 8, kind of just targeted to keep consumers from getting letters of solicitation from healthcare providers or lawyers who have gotten their names and addresses from accident reports filed with the state. And when people have been in an accident, there's the accident report is public, and their mailbox starts filling up with those marketing letters, and I think that's inappropriate. So I think this gets at some reform that's pretty small in scope and very targeted. Certainly not going to, I think, cause any great stress or strain in the system. It'll go on working. We'll continue to have no fault. But I've been concerned about increasing costs. It is true, and if Senator Olson were here, she would say that the number of lawsuits has come down. But the costs, of course, the medical costs have gone up dramatically. So this is an attempt to do something about those costs in the system and also add some benefit by increasing those amounts for the funeral expense and for wage loss. And I have Mr. Johnson. Maybe would like to say something.
Senator Scheid, before you do that, you mentioned that
six.
You wanted to delete Section 6.
Yes.
Senator Scheid moves to delete Section 6 from the bill. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Mr. Johnson, I think Senator Scheid did a very good job explaining and taking us through the bill. If you have anything else that you want to add other than saying that you're supportive, I welcome that, but I thought maybe we could have
Well, so let me give you that opportunity, if that's okay. Is that all right? Let's take. All right. Thank you. Thank you. We have a lot of bills to go through, so I'm just trying to expedite us a little bit here.
I think that's fine.
And then your other testifier is that your other testifier? Or is this Mr. Frentz?
It's Brett Olander.
Olander. I'm Brett Olander, Madam Chair.
Can you put the microphone in front of you? We have to record the testimony, so.
Sure. Do you want me to comment?
Sure. Senator? Just short.
Okay.
Just briefly.
Very brief. And I wasn't going to bring my kids today. Thank heavens I didn't. They would have been running around here. On the two issues, the arbitration provision talking about if an arbitrator denies certain benefits that the provider can't go after the individual or another insurer, that's something we've had in workers' comp, which I used to do for at least 15 years because I haven't done it for 15 years and it's was in there before that. We think at least, a good provision to allow fair outcomes to arbitration, the arbitration process without the provider going after the individual if the bills are denied. And then the other issue that I think is critical that Senator Scheid commented on is the portion of recovering the excess billing that providers bill following treatment that's actually not being claimed by anyone that exceeds the amount paid by insurance. That's something presently under some conflicting court cases. The TZAC case and the Faust case find you can recover that. There's an old 1990 Court of Appeals unpublished case, Michelet versus Dial Corporation, that says you can't. And in this recent Court of Appeals case from about 2 weeks ago, Swanson versus Brewster, unpublished, but there was comment that this is something that should be addressed legislatively. And this court specifically said, just one sentence, I'll read, the legislature's failure to define payment or paid in Minnesota's collateral source statute has created uncertainty and led to inconsistent decisions in this court. And so that makes this issue, timely.
Okay.
And just for background, I'm a civil litigation
give
attorney.
Give us your name again and then your background.
Brett Olander. I do insurance defense work for State Farm, and I do a lot of arbitration mediation work as a party-selected mediator arbitrator. I'm for the injury victim getting fully compensated. I'm not here to speak on behalf of State Farm. I'm just talking about fairness in the process. And I think this arbitration provision is a very good outcome, and it would make our no-fault law consistent with work comp law, which is also no-fault law. And on the other question on collateral sources, would make our law consistent with what the intention of the collateral source statute was, 548.36, I believe it is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olander. Then let's have, Mr. Frentz and Mr. Wolf come up. Mr. Frentz?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Nick Frentz. I'm a member of the Minnesota Association for Justice, currently serving 2 years as the legislative chair. I appreciate the opportunity to briefly address this committee. I'm also a practitioner on behalf of automobile accident victims and their families for 22 years in Blue Earth County in Mankato. I want to start by assuring this committee that although I am listed as someone speaking against the bill, I would prefer to be characterized as someone who wants to make points for the committee's consideration on behalf of consumers. Senator Scheid and I both would like to see a bill that benefits consumers. We do have some significant differences of opinion about the benefits that consumers would reap under this bill. If I may briefly, to put it in context, Minnesota currently has between 35,000 and 40,000 automobile accident victims, people injured in accidents each year. We have about 2 million people that are insured, 2 million plus. So that's what we're talking about, 35 to 40,000 Minnesotans. You have a no-fault system, which is excellent. In the 22 years I've done exclusively this work, and I cannot tell you how many times people involved in accidents have complimented this system that the legislature has created. Automatic payment of your medical bills, reimbursement for wage loss, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. We have 100 people injured a day in Minnesota, so this bill significantly affects large numbers of Minnesota citizens. Now, philosophically, I have worked on medical malpractice issues. I have examined other states' responses, and my first concern for this committee is very simple. Simply allowing insurance companies to pay injured people less benefits will not automatically lead to 100% reduction in premiums. This is something that can be discussed outside the committee, but just because you allow the insurance companies to pay people hurt in car accidents less will not automatically benefit consumers with 100% reduction of premiums. And I very much appreciate the candor of Senator Scheid when the comment is made, this will not greatly reduce premiums. If it does reduce benefits for consumers and it doesn't greatly reduce premiums, I hope you begin to see our concern on behalf of the people that we work for. Now, just briefly, if I may, the individual provisions of this bill. 65B.44 subdivision 2 merely attempts to give a definition of medical expenses as those bills that are actually paid. I believe this may be better placed somewhere else or eliminated. The rest of the subsection says what medical expense benefits are, x-rays, rehabilitative services, so that it is a bit unclear how a medical expense could be defined as what's paid. A medical expense is an x-ray, a surgery, that type of thing. I fully agree and support what Senator Scheid has proposed on behalf of consumers in the next two subdivisions. Subdivision 3 of 65B44 would increase the weekly wage loss maximum to $500. I can tell you, as a practitioner in this field, that is long overdue. Even in my relatively rural county of Blue Earth, the average monthly wage is over $1,500, so $250 a week, even when the system works properly, can put consumers in a very difficult position. Likewise, we have above 500 fatalities a year, and increasing the funeral benefit expense in Subdivision 4 of that same statute, in the opinion of many of the practitioners, is long overdue. Now, that's probably where the agreements about what benefits consumers diverge. First of all, 65B.51 sub 1 talks about the collateral source setoffs. I would respectfully suggest that the courts of Minnesota have ruled on this, probably most recently in Fisher versus Western National of August 08. I won't belabor this committee except to say that I believe a responsible look at what the state courts have done in this matter is to support the current law. The benefit of purchasing the insurance goes to that consumer that paid for it, and this proposal would change that benefit. Now, probably the most contentious part of this bill is the next section, 65B.51 subdivision 3. I look forward to a chance to work with Senator Scheid and other interested parties on this provision, but if there were a sense that this was about to become law, the greatest number of consumers would ask to come before you and testify against this next provision. It is very simple. It decreases the number of consumers who are entitled to receive general damages. Now, it does that by changing how you define who is eligible to receive general damages. General damages are generally described as pain and suffering, emotional distress, or what we call non-economic damages. And by defining the medical expense as what is paid rather than what is charged, you simply shrink the number of people that are eligible to receive the general damages.
I'm a little bit confused, Mr. Frentz. So explain that again. The line point 327, reasonable medical expense benefits, this is current law, paid.
I have to apologize.
Payable or payable but for any applicable deductible. By putting the word actually in front of it, so under current law, you're able to put emotional distress and all the other under the claim for medical expense benefits?
No, and I have to apologize because I could speak English before I got to law school, and ever since it's been quite a challenge. This is 65B.51 sub 3, and for the benefit of everyone who hasn't worked in this particular area, this is a threshold question. One of the features of our No-Fault Act, which is designed to protect insurance companies, is that an injured party must meet a minimum threshold of injury, so that one of the thresholds is $4,000 of medical expense. Does that make some sense?
Not yet.
Okay.
It's on line 26. It says you don't get damages unless the sum exceeds $4,000. So that's the threshold I think he's speaking about.
So I understand, Mr. Frentz, you're saying that what Senator Scheid had said earlier, which is if the RAC amount is $4,100, the actual amount is $2,200. If we went with the actual amount, then they wouldn't meet that threshold.
Absolutely. And I can certainly testify from my own practice and having represented in the neighborhood of 4,000 people injured in these accidents, that that's going to cover a substantial number of people each year in the state of Minnesota. This, too, has been visited by our courts. And when this legislature determined that threshold, it was their intent that it be the RAC rate, if I could use that term, so that the impact of this particular provision would simply be to take a certain category of people injured in accidents and say, under the old law, you would have been entitled to receive general damages no longer.
And Mr. Frentz, I think your problem is not Senator Scheid's language tried to actually get to the transparency of the actual payment. It might be that you need to work with Senator Scheid on the 4,000 limit.
Well, first of all, as to the thresholds, I hope that's always something that's able to be discussed. One of the difficulties that practitioners have with that provision, Madam Chair, is that it creates a distinction between people whose bills are paid by the no-fault carrier, paid at the RAC rate, and those whose may be paid by Blue Cross or another carrier. When they may have had the identical treatment, one group would meet the threshold and one would not.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. As I understand, the provision provided in this bill has been withdrawn, 65B.525, so I will simply skip over that. The next provision is 65B.547. This is the balance billing provision. This seems to me to be more for the providers, healthcare providers, to address. The only concern that I would have on behalf of consumers is that would appear to limit access to healthcare insofar as certain providers may not be willing to provide care to someone injured in an accident if there is this provision in place which may prevent them from being paid for that work. And I would simply ask that, as a policy matter, we would like to have people have access to the full range of treatment that benefits them. It also has an aspect of placing the arbitrator at a different level of authority to determine when doctors are or are not paid, but I'm not smart enough to tell this committee which is preferable as a policy matter. As far as the electronic database, which relates to the ability, this is the next section, which is 16909 sub 13. I testified earlier this week for the Commerce Committee, and Senator Olson did raise the issue of the constitutional basis on which you might prevent people from communicating about their services. I guess all I could say is that as written, it seems to say only that you can't get the electronic database, making it more difficult to get the records to doctors and lawyers who write that, but not impossible. And I can say on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, there are not strong feelings about that provision. I do support Senator Olson's concern that if you limit free speech, you may face the constitutional challenge. And the final provisions, 60401 and 60402, relate to the application of joint and several liability. And I would simply ask to make that part of the general discussion. I do think at the end of the day we'd like to have a bill that's good for consumers, and it would be our suggestion to this committee that this particular bill overall would not be supported by consumers if they had all the facts. And I look forward to the chance to work on the bill further. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Senators.
Thank you, Mr. Frentz. And then Mr. Wolf.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity. I'm Dr. John Wolf. I'm a compliance officer for Northwestern Health Sciences University, and I've been doing that for a couple of years. But prior to that, I spent 19 years engaged in a practice similar to Mr. Frentz, representing injured people. And for 12 of those years, I was a no-fault arbitrator. I've probably arbitrated hundreds of no-fault arbitrations. I am here today, however, at a request of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association to address the issue that Mr. Frentz suggested needed addressing, and that is how does the balance billing provision affect consumers and the providers. I agree with that testimony that the balance billing provision makes a no-fault claimant a second-class citizen. If an injured person wants treatment and a doctor says, well, whether or not I get paid is now out of my hands. It's in the hands of the skill of my patient's lawyer. If in the case where my patient is injured as a result of their own fault, it's now in the rhetorical skills of my unrepresented patient against the lawyer for the insurance company. And the concern, the very apparent concern, is that the doctor in that situation is going to say, well, rehab is very time-intensive. They're time-based codes billed in 15-minute increments. If whether or not I'm going to get paid or have recourse to get paid is going to be completely out of my control, let's skip the rehab on this one. Let's skip the imaging, the expensive diagnostic imaging on this particular patient, if whether or not we're going to get paid for it is, you know, so completely up in the air. So suddenly, the no-fault claimant who would present as good a prospect for payment as any other type of patient suddenly becomes one where, you know, this is up in the air, and it's completely out of the doctor's control as to whether or not there may be payment from the no-fault insurer. But the balance billing provision then says you can't go anywhere else, right? Not only have we turned this healthcare consumer into a second-class citizen, but there are other issues with this, and I think unintended consequences. I think overall, at first blush, it makes perfect sense, but when we look at the unintended consequences that could come to pass, it comes out being fairly anti-consumer and certainly anti-provider. It interferes with the doctor-patient relationship, the contractual relationship between doctor-patient. It even throws a provision in there saying, you know, notwithstanding anything that the doctor may want the patient to agree with. But more
where
important,
does,
it interferes
Dr.
with...
Dr. Wolf?
Yes.
Where is that?
It is... Section 7. Yeah, it's Section 7, but it's the...
I believe it's 65B.54, Subdivision 7, Madam Chair.
Page 4,
Madam
Chair.
Page 4?
Having to do with balance billing.
Oh, it's not that. The line I just mentioned is not in the balance billing section, so I don't want to comment on anything other than the balance billing. So I'll skip that.
Okay.
But this does interfere with the injured person's contractual relations with other insurers that may come into play. The situation not addressed is, suppose we have an arbitrator takes it upon herself to say, you know, I believe part of what the treating doctor says, and I believe part of what the adverse examiner says. So I'm going to say that half of this patient's medical expenses are due to her old athletic injuries, and half are due to this car accident. Suddenly, the provider who has been providing those services isn't going to get half. They're going to get zero of the other half. In other words, they can't bill the patient's health insurer for those for treatment or evaluation or diagnosis of those injuries determined by the arbitrator to be due to, for example, the unrelated athletic injury. And that, again, makes the injured person less attractive to the provider if it's going to be completely almost capricious at some points whether or not we're going to get paid. We really want to do the expensive things, knowing that we're advancing this essentially expense out of our own pocket with great uncertainty as to whether or not it can be reimbursed. Finally, I think one of the unintended consequences is that when thinking this through, one would have to ask, what happens to the claimant and the bills of the no-fault claimant, who loses at arbitration but wins at trial. The doctor has provided services and not been paid as a result of the arbitration. Also, as a result of this legislation, the doctor would not be able to bill the patient's health insurer. Then even when the patient goes to try her case and prevails at court and medical expenses are awarded, they still can't go to the doctor. So those are the four reasons I would respectfully submit that there are unintended consequences to the legislation that are not good for patients or consumers or providers.
Dr. Wolf, I appreciate your comments, but I guess I'm having a hard time in connecting some of the points that you've made to the proposed changes in the bill. If you could be very specific to what the language is, I mean, you're certainly raising some good points, but the committee can't help address those points if we're not seeing how the bill does those or achieves those unintended consequences. Well, Senator Scheid?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that that last statement is true. If you go to trial, I don't know, maybe you're limited to nothing above the arbitrator's award, but why are you in trial? I mean, of course they could pay those. I think a court could decide that those would be paid if the arbitrator was wrong, because now you didn't agree with the arbitration, so you took it to trial. I don't see how you couldn't be awarded those unless you don't win at trial.
Madam Chairman, Senator Scheid, I'm referring specifically to Section 7, Sub 7, B. If it is determined by the arbitrator that the medical expenses were blah, 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 or other unnecessary, then the provider shall not be paid for that procedure from any, I think it says, any other source. I can,
Senator
from
Scheid?
Experience, it happens with extreme frequency. In a case where we have a claimant who has both a no-fault claim and a tort claim against an at-fault driver, it happens with significant frequency that we can get stiffed at arbitration but still win a trial. Under the language of this subdivision, we could win a trial and still be stiffed.
Madam Chair, I don't think that's the intent. I think it anticipates that there might be a court proceeding. I don't think it says you cannot go to the court and win your case. I mean, I don't see that it says that. I think if the arbitrator or the court says that, then you're not going to be paid. But if you go to court and the court doesn't find that, I don't see how you're prevented from being compensated. And I would say, Madam Chair, that the issue here to me seems to be what's medically necessary. And that an arbitrator, I'm sure you looked at that as an arbitrator, at what was necessary. And, you know, we've had situations where insurers have paid $4,000 for a machine that you pass over your arm. I don't think it's laser beam. I don't know what kind of a beam it sends. And it's something that I know Mr. Johnson was able to buy online for like $85 or something, for $50. Excuse me, but the insurer paid $4,000 for it because it was somebody deemed it medically necessary. Well, I think we need to think about the kind of costs, you know, we're adding in. Now, that's not directly on point here, but the truth is we're paying for some things that I think may not be medically necessary, or certainly not the level of expense is not warranted. And yet, that's in our system. And you and I, not as accident victims, but as consumers of insurance, and we have to have insurance in Minnesota, we are paying for those kinds of what I think are extravagances in the system. So we're just trying to narrow down a couple little places, and I think it's really modest, and bump up some benefit. And I'm asking the committee to offer some balance here, offer reform, and also, you know, cutting costs in the system and also improving benefit on the other hand for the injured person. So I was going to say also to something that Mr. Frentz said. He's talking about limitation on general on damages. If you, I go back to my chemotherapy treatment, I didn't get to claim. I mean, I pay the insurance premium, arguably, and I didn't get to claim the difference between the $11,000 and the $2,500 that was actually paid. I mean, that doesn't even make sense. That's about a medical expense. It's not about other kinds of damages. And then I would also point out to the members that on that system, when you're looking at that $4,000 threshold, I don't have the numbers, but I think that most cases actually fall down on B rather than A. I think that permanent disfigurement, the scar on my hand right here that not one of you has ever seen, is a permanent disfigurement under current law. And the scar on my knee, also from an auto accident, is something you've never seen. You are very lucky. And it's very small. But it's also a permanent disfigurement under current law. And it falls right in because it just, this is, I don't even have to meet the threshold if I have that, I believe.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Scheid, I mean, I'm trying to look closely at the language on page 4, line 28 of the sentences. If it is determined by arbitration or court proceeding that the level, frequency, or cost of medical expenses benefits is excessive, unreasonable, or unnecessary, the provider shall not be paid for the procedure, service, or cost by the reparation obligor. Now, I can understand if the arbitrator or the court says this was unnecessary, not paid. If they say it's unreasonable, okay, that means you shouldn't have done. Excessive, I'm not quite sure, because that word suggests that, well, some of the stuff should have been done. You maybe have done too much. So instead of, maybe we would say, well, we can agree that you should have done part of it, but not everything that you did. But I think a reading of this would say that the provider may not be paid for any of it, even if the arbitrator of the court decides that some of it was necessary and reasonable. Excessive, I think, is a problem.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
That may be. I have to think on that, but I think I didn't read it as carefully as you just did now. I mean, with it, looking at that, I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No. Senator Betzel.
I think, just for the moment, if you wanted to strike excessive, I mean, I think unreasonable or necessary, I think, gets to the point that you were just describing. There may be a better way to describe what excessive is, but I think right now that's all or nothing, and that causes a problem.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I think I agree because I think unreasonable could cover the same situation if, and I think we could understand unreasonable better than excessive. I think that's fine, and I'd...
Senator Betzel, your motion?
Madam Chair, I think the way to do it would be on page 4, line 29, strike the word excessive in the comma. Line 4.30, strike the first comma, and I think that would do it.
Yeah.
All right. On the motion, Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair and Senators Betzel and Scheid, I had the same concern, but mine goes a little bit maybe beyond where Senator Betzel was, because what this language says is that if a procedure is determined to be excessive, unreasonable, or unnecessary, as Senator Betzel said, the provider shall not be paid at all. But I guess my question is, do you want the court to reduce the amount to a reasonable amount, or do you want them to say that they cannot pay for any procedure at all? I think you want them to be able to pay for a procedure in a reasonable amount. And so I think it goes beyond what Senator Betzel is saying, and we may want to put in there something about I was thinking line 4.30, the provider shall not be paid beyond what is a reasonable amount for the procedure, for any necessary procedure service, something like that. I'm not sure which one is better, Senator Betzold. I think mine goes just a little bit further, but I think we want to make sure that the procedures are necessary and that the providers get paid a reasonable amount.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think that's fine. I understand.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold.
I think to incorporate Senator Ortman's thoughts, again, if on 4.29 you strike the word excessive in the comma, line 4.30 strike the first comma, and on 4.30, after the word paid, it says a provider shall not be paid, add the words more than a reasonable amount. I think that would provide for, you know, payment for what was necessary and reasonable.
On Senator Scheid's motion, on Senator Betzold's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid, as I was looking at this, it appears that I know that you had mentioned that the actually paid language,
yes,
is intended to clarify or to modify tort the no fault section of the statute.
Madam Chair, it also is a reference to the collateral source statute as well, I think.
Right, and so the general tort law, is that your intention, is to, because I think Section 9 and 11 seem to also. Ms. Pontius, could you, because I asked Ms. Pontius to look at this for me, and maybe she could just speak to that.
Madam Chair, members, yeah, Sections 10 and 11 also amend the comparative fault statute as well, so it does potentially, well, it does go beyond no-fault situations. I'm not familiar with the underlying issue in terms of the case law, but it is more than no-fault that's in the bill.
If I could, Madam Chair, just briefly, I'd just like to remind the
Mr. committee. Mr. Frentz.
Thank you. First of all, it's worth mentioning for this committee that we have different standards of proof for no-fault arbitrations than for the tort claims that are brought in court. I think the attorneys in this room would agree generally it is easier to prevail given the current state of case law and statute and the no-fault arbitrations than it is in the tort law. And I share some of the concerns raised. The principal concern I think consumers would have is this bill's effect on their current tort rights, and that is present also in Subdivision 7. I'm aware of Senator Scheid's comments about the intention on page 4, on the threshold, rather. There are several examples, such as Mr. Wolf gave, that I could cite for you about how this might be awkward. In particular, we talked this week about a provider who's trying to heal a patient and then a no-fault arbitration denies some of the bills, certainly placing that provider and that patient in a potentially very awkward situation. But I won't belabor those points. There are many ways in which we thought this was difficult, but our principal concern on behalf of consumers was its effect on the rights they have in tort. And if what Senator Scheid is saying is that you would have another bite at the apple, so to speak, under Minnesota's tort law in court to prove the medical expenses were reasonable and necessary and related to the accident, I admit that is different from how I read this bill and how the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Association for Justice read it. And I certainly agree consumers would be far better protected if that reading were accurate. So,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to move to take Section 5 out just so we can. That isn't the only place where actually paid goes, but I don't want it.
Senator Betzold?
Well, Madam Chair, I went through the bill, I was kind of wondering what actually meant because I thought maybe we should put the word really or something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
And then put.
We mean it.
Yeah. But I think I understand the issue a little bit more, the difference between what's charged and what's paid or actually paid or really paid, but it does show up in about a couple or truly paid. And if the courts are saying that they don't understand what paid means, and we have to clarify it. I'm not sure if that's exactly the word I would use, but it does seem to be in a number of different places. I think pages 4, 5, 9, 10, and 11, we're using the term actually in getting there. So,
awesome.
I mean, I don't know that deleting Section 5, you know, takes care of the other places where that wonderful word pops up. But
no, Madam Chair,
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, I didn't pretend that it did, but I think we don't need to have that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I would hate to see Senator Scheid remove that section. I think we're just starting to get to the heart of the bill right there, which is why are we including bills that aren't actually paid? I mean, I get Senator Betzel's concerned, actually, and really, and maybe we want to put in a whole definition of actually in the bill. I mean, I think that's what we're getting at, which is a billing looks different than a payment. And maybe you can just distinguish in your legislation, not a bill, but just to keep us straight here, distinguish in the legislation what is a payment versus what is an invoice, and that only payments can be accrued towards the $4,000 and not invoices.
Perhaps. Madam Chair, I leave it to the committee. I think what we're trying to do, Madam Chair, is get away from the ambiguity I think that the courts have found here.
And Senator Scheid, I mean, it's your intention to just address the no-fault sections of the bill. I mean, to address the no-fault statute. Clarify the no-fault statute. You don't want to, your intention is not to go broader than that.
Madam Chair, no, it isn't. But I think the collateral source piece
does go for it.
Because, well, that's used.
That might be, but 10 and 11.
Under the no-fault.
Yeah. That's insurance.
So, Senator Scheid, I think counsel advises that you could probably leave Section 5 in, but maybe 10 and 11 is what is not necessary. If your intention here is to address the actually, truly, honestly paid in the no-fault section of the statutes.
And Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Johnson to comment on that. Phone a friend. We're a shout out. Only hurts sometimes.
Mr. Olander.
I think you could get rid of 10 and 11. I think Brett Olander.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. There's so many judges up here. In court, I know who to talk to. So. I think you're right. Was it Kathy that came
Ms. Pontius,
up with that?
Yes.
Ms. Pontius, I'm sorry.
Yes.
That you could get rid of 10 and 11. That's comparative fault statute.
Okay.
I'm not sure why it was in there to begin with, frankly. It needs to be in 548. So that's section 9, I believe it is.
Okay.
That's a collateral source statute. That's the collateral source statute that case that I talked about earlier was dealing with. So I agree
Very good.
With that.
So Senator Scheid moves to delete sections 10 and 11.
Yes.
Is that right? All right. On that motion.
Well, Madam
Chair, any further discussion? Senator Betzel.
Just to be clear, I think 10 and 11 is the part where we say we really mean it, so I don't mind taking it out.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
What about just above 10?
There's a comma missing?
No. But I could find one, I'm sure. 7.23 to 7.25, it says the same language as 10 and 11, so I don't know if you want to consider that or not. I don't know.
Yep. That's the collateral source.
That's the part that we really, really,
yeah.
really mean.
That's okay. kind of the gray area.
Actually, true.
I really, really
actually.
really, truly,
okay.
honestly want.
Alrighty.
All right. On the motion to delete section 10 and 11, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
So 5 is back in. Or still in.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Senator Scheid, you didn't move to strike Section 5, did you?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. She just offered to strike Section
Madam
5.
Chair, if I did, I withdraw it.
Senator Scheid, any further discussions on Senate File 1310? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move then that Senate File 1310 as amended be recommended to pass.
And it goes to the floor. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
and I really mean it.
Motion
actually
really
goes
prevails.
Actually.
It actually prevails. Yeah.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel?
Yes.
Oh, were you asking to make a comment?
Said,
or was
no,
that Senator?
I said I actually really voted for it.
All right. Moving right along.
Members, what I'd like to do is, let's see. Is there something we can kind of get off the list before we break?
1196 should be short. Senator Foley's.
Can we take Senator Foley's bill?
Yeah. That way, if we got
Senator Foley? Yeah. 1196.
Yeah. Then we come back to my bills.
Senator Foley, Senate File 1196.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1196 deals with a bill that I'm carrying for the 4th Judicial District.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, would you pull that microphone up closer, please? I'm having a hard time hearing today.
It isn't that I
not
speak
our fault that you're losing your...
Yeah, it's a family thing.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Senator Foley.
But what we have is a matter that deals with the Misdemeanor Violations Bureaus in Minneapolis and southern, northern, and western suburban locations. And, Madam Chair, I do have a technical violation that council will.
There's a technical amendment. Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, on page 1, line 8, after bureaus, insert in the 4th Judicial District. And Madam Chair and members, that just clarifies that we're talking about the Hennepin County, the 4th Judicial District.
That oral amendment is author's amendment to put the bill into the shape he would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
In our packet, we have a delete all amendment to this. Is that Senator Foley's amendment? Or
1196?
The A1.
Madam Chair, that is a mistake.
No. Mr. Backus, is that's a mistake.
Never mind.
And then Senator Foley, that's the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to have Judge Cahill speak on the issue and tell you why we need this legislation.
Judge?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me on this bill. The purpose of the bill essentially is to establish consistency with other counties that have multiple court locations within the county. In those other counties, such as Ramsey and St. Louis County, the majority of judges in the district determine where court will be held and where violations bureaus are. And the intent here is to make that consistent for Hennepin County, where the majority of judges would determine where court and violations bureau are. Repealing the Bloomington Municipal Court language is almost, I think, a technical correction. It's a throwback to the old municipal court system where municipal court was being held in the Bloomington City Hall. Having said that, I don't think the committee should be concerned that we are eager to close court locations. That is obviously something that we take very seriously. One of the priorities of the branch is still to have access to justice, and we are mindful that the court locations we have in the suburbs are very busy. For example, the Brookdale Court has more filings than 80 of the counties themselves, so that gives you an idea how busy they are. So,
thank you, Judge.
But we do appreciate the chance to make our powers in the 4th Judicial District consistent with the other districts and determine how to appropriately allocate resources and conduct court business. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Senator Foley moves that Senate File 1196 as amended be recommended to pass and place on the consent calendar. Any further discussions?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I'm going to support the bill. I just wondered, there was conversation this last year, I think, about, you know, closing down Brookdale, which is in an area that I represent. And how could they was that this is for misdemeanor violations. I don't know how this is different from that conversation that was held. And, of course, they decided to keep it that located at Brookdale. I just transportation's an issue in the communities that I represent, and wondered how that works.
Madam Judge? Chair and Senator Scheid, there was some discussion about closing a division of the court as a cost-saving mechanism. That's still obviously always an item for discussion. As I said, it's one thing we want to avoid if possible. The statute actually does not require court to be held in any location except a southern suburban. It's only the Misdemeanor Violations Bureau, nor how much business should be handled by that. It's not our intent at this time, I think. But we do want it as a tool in the tool belt just in case budget cuts get even worse than they are.
It's consent calendar, all right, Senator Scheid?
I suppose I wonder, I don't know if anybody else would have any problems with it on the floor. No, it's fine with me.
Okay. All right. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Chair?
Oh,
aye.
Sorry. Sorry. Senator Orman?
I'm sorry. I am supportive of this bill. I just think we probably should discuss it and that it maybe would be misleading on the consent agenda. I think maybe the vote will be 67 to nothing. But I do think that it warrants a little bit more review than just a consent agenda.
That's fine. Then we'll be sent to the floor.
Thank you.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. You know, Mr. Black is sitting in the audience, and I guess we have two pretty short Betzel bills. Members, if it's okay with you, I'd like to take up 214, the Betzel 214, and the Betzel 1224, so that we can get Mr. Black out of here. Although he put on a nice tie and that beautiful red handkerchief to brighten up our day. Senator Betzel, Senate File 214.
Madam Chair, Senate File 214 deals with notaries public, and there was a task force established by the Secretary of State's office that spent the better part of a year reviewing legislation dealing with it, and this is the result of the bill. The bill's already been heard in the Commerce Committee, and it comes to us here. Let me just go through a couple of things here. The bill does have in Section 1, there's a fee that's paid right now for notaries, but it's confusing as to where the money goes and who's to collect it, because part of it goes to the county, part of it goes to the state, and so forth. So this just has the consolidation of the fee going to the Secretary of State's office, and they will distribute the same money to the places where it's going to be. There's no change in it. But in Section 1, that's taught. They do change who's collecting it and where it actually goes. Section 2 deals with an issue that was a bill that the governor vetoed. We tried to raise the notary fee from $1 to $5, and he complained that I think it was a 500% increase. Well, he was wrong. It's a 400% increase. But there's no requirement anywhere that a notary has to charge anything for notary services. However, this fee has not been raised in, I think, the better part of 20 years. And it used to be, I think, 100 years ago, it was like 25 cents. And so it went for many years without being any change at all. But it's felt that the $1 for those people who do have to charge for notary services, that's still way too insufficient for them. So, and by the way, the notary commission was raised dramatically a couple of years ago, but the amount that the notary can charge was not changed. So this does revisit an issue. In Section 3, this is something that should be of interest to legislators, because legislators, by virtue of holding their office, are authorized to be notaries. However, there is no procedure for how we're supposed to notarize things or even have a stamp. This provides that we have to have a stamp rather than using a seal for notarization. In Section 4, that authorizes public officials to use a notary stamp instead of a seal. Again, you know, that's more of the common practice. In Section 5, we're dealing establishing the format by which city and county officials in their capacity as ex officio notaries. Again, this sets out procedures that currently we're authorized to do it as ex officio notaries. It just doesn't tell us how we're supposed to do it or the form we're supposed to do it. And that's what is done in here. In Section 6, we have situations where notaries have to notarize documents that are in a foreign language. And, of course, all the notary does is authenticate that the person who signed it is really the person who signed it. the notary is not verifying what's in the document or even saying, you know, what the translated document is supposed to be. So the notary is simply making clear that the notary is in English notarizing the notarization, but not the document itself. And that's always been the case. And in some cases, also in Section 6, sometimes you have cases where a notary uses a nickname and signs the nickname, but then the stamp has a different name. So we want the notary to use the same name when you're signing the document as appears on the commission and on the stamp, not to use different names all the time. Section 7 talks about having a uniform size of notary stamp within the seal, again, for ex-official members. In Section 8, that deals with it increases the number of people that employer can consider for service as a notary in their operation for people who are commuting in adjoining states. Right now, we allow people in adjoining states to be notaries, have notarized documents, but they have to record their documents in the adjoining county of Minnesota. But it's only for those adjoining counties. So we're recognizing that there are people in Wisconsin or Iowa or North and South Dakota that probably can have notary commissions, but they're going to have to file their commission, you know, in a county, Minnesota, but they don't have to live in an adjoining county. So that's one of the things that we did there. Section 9 deals with the split of the fees, where it's supposed to go to. It's going to go file with the Secretary of State's office, and they'll divide the money. Section 10 authorized the Commissioner of Commerce to authorize a background check if the commissioner desires to do so for a criminal background check. And Section 11 is clearing up that the commission expires on January 31st of the fifth year after it's commissioned, and it actually gives a longer period of time to apply for renewal. Right now it's 2 months. This just makes it a longer period of time. Six months to renew your commission. And Section 12, this deals again with ex officios completing their certification and providing the format and clarifying that the notary is using a stamp. In Section 13, this also clarifies a uniform use of a stamp rather than a seal. Section 14 deals with the simplification process of the stamp instead of the seal. Section 15 provides for electronic notarization, more consistent because there are electronic notifications, and this clarifies that process. Section 16 we have a specific reference in here for the county assigning the duties for court administrators. The notary is supposed to be filed with the court administrator. However, in some counties, they've moved the court administrator's office, where there's a large district court area, to some other area. So there may not be a court administrator's office within a different county. This indicates where the commission is to be recorded if you don't have a court administrator's office in there. In Section 17, those are situations disabilities, that's right. Yeah, we have people who have to sign documents and they're disabled and they cannot physically sign their name. And we do have a provision right now in statute for how they're supposed to do it. This just clarifies those provisions in there. And finally, it gives if somebody is losing their notary commission, then they have to turn their stamp into the Commissioner of Commerce, and that's Section 18. So as I say, there are a lot of things that were done in that commission, and there were some recommendations that they made, a number that they did not make. They talked about having notaries keep an official journal. That was rejected. Mandatory background checks were rejected. These are permissive. Eliminating bond, that was discussed and eliminated. Training for notaries. So as I say, this is a pretty non-controversial bill, as I understand it, and actually for ex-official notaries, it actually gives us more guidance than we have now. Madam Chair, members, that's the bill.
Senator Betzel or Mr. Black, I'm curious about the new language in Section 10. The reason for the new authorization for the criminal background check, and then secondly, what is 45.027 and 45.028? Mr. Black.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be heard. By the way, this is better than where I was 25 years ago on deadline night. I don't know if Ms. Pontius had joined the committee yet, but I was the next to last bill on an agenda that lasted. I came on at 3:45 in the morning after a bill that discussed the rule against perpetuities.
Oh, no.
It was appropriate.
It was, yes. So right now is just fine. The language here was recommended by the Department of Commerce has the enforcement function for notaries. Secretary of State has the registration function. I'm sorry, Bert Black, legal advisor, Secretary of State, for the record. Right now there is a process where on the notary application you have to answer four questions that relate to any previous convictions or other violations of that nature. And in that case, the Commerce Department does an investigation, but they are not authorized right now to do the traditional criminal background check. They apparently have other ways of doing background investigations. So that is the source of Clause B there, to allow them to do the actual background check through the BCA, through the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The language in Clause C, 45.027 and 028, is the general language that's provided to the Department of Commerce for the investigation of persons who are licensees with Commerce. Commerce licenses about, I think it's 22 different occupations, and all of those occupations are subject to 45.027. The reason for inserting the language here, registration function was transferred to the Secretary of State about, I think it was 3.5 years ago. And before that time, the registration was with the Commissioner of Commerce, and so this was automatically covered under Section 45.027 and 028. It was the feeling of the Department of Commerce that at the time that we transferred the registration function, we probably should have put this language in at that time, because the registration was now under Secretary of State.
Well, Mr. Black, we just spent a whole hearing on collateral sanctions in this committee, and I'm wondering if are we, in essence, creating another opportunity for somebody who could potentially be barred from becoming a notary public because something in their past criminal record is going to get triggered where they will now be denied the opportunity?
Madam Chair, I think notary publics are different because notary publics are actually appointed officials. There is no right to be a notary public. There is no test. There is no license. Fill out the form and pay the application fee, but it's actually an appointment by the governor, which is confirmed by the Senate. Yes. Although I don't think you ever see the list, Mr. Watson told me they just refer to the computer printout at the desk, and that's how these people are confirmed, because there are thousands of them. But there's no particular right to be a notary. It's an appointment by the governor. So I think this is a little different kind of situation, perhaps, than the one you were discussing.
I understand that, Mr. Black. So if that is the case, then I'm even more concerned, because then who will suddenly be asked to be subjected to the criminal background check and who won't be?
Madam Chair, I believe the process of the Department of Commerce is that if you answer yes to any of the four questions on the notary form that go to questions of trustworthiness, that is the trigger for their current background check. So it is not everybody. It's where there is a red flag. There are some other states that do require a criminal history check. Those states are California, New Hampshire, Oregon, and Missouri. Missouri has the same and South Dakota. Missouri has the same system we have, where the check only occurs if one of these red flag type questions is answered yes.
Senator Betzel, I'd like an opportunity to kind of think on this provision. Would you be willing to delete this provision from the bill for now?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll also move to delete, what is it, section?
Just, is it just B? Just B. Is it the whole thing?
Well, it's
section 10.
Madam Chair, I think that your concern in section 10 is on lines 7.22 to 7.23.
Yep.
But having every authorize a criminal background check, I think it's still a good idea to do that as part of their application process. So I think you're mainly interested in. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, apparently they want to keep 7.22 and 2.3 and delete 7.20 and 2.1.
Well, I'm concerned about both provisions, and I'd like a chance to maybe talk with Mr. Black further about that.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll move to delete Section 10.
Thank you, Senator Betzel. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question? What about somebody who's a legislator? Could they be barred then if they had that something in their background? They're not barred from serving, but I just wondered if they're automatically.
This wouldn't affect that.
Mr. Black?
Applicants, I guess.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid. Actually, an ex officio legislator wouldn't be under 359 because those are the folks who apply and pay the fee. So the legislators would not be affected by that link.
So, and Madam Chair, that makes the point that you could serve in the legislature and have an issue. I think it even goes, to misdemeanor or something. I was reading someplace else.
Arrests.
And,
please.
You know, and not have to apply. So this wouldn't apply. I understand this wouldn't apply to you as a legislator or to us as legislators, but I just wanted to make the point that that would be kind of a dual system.
We'll work with Senator Betzel on this provision. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, earlier in the day I had gone back and asked Mr. Black about whether legislators now could have a stamp, and he said, yes, it's in this bill. Because during the recount, the U.S. Senate recount, there was a discussion that I was listening to online about if somebody's absentee ballot was notarized but there was no stamp, then it was considered not notarized. And last year I tried to actually get a stamp, a notary stamp, as a legislator, and the company that I went to said, we don't do that. We don't have a stamp for legislators. And I thought, if somebody had actually asked us to notarize their absentee ballot, and then just because we don't have a stamp, their ballot could have been thrown out. I thought that was a little fixable, and I'm glad that it is fixed in this. But I have a question on, I guess it's page 5. There are several references to title and rank. And I'm wondering whose title and whose rank.
Mr. Black?
This is current law.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, that is current law, but I think that has to do with...
is that like the deputies people?
No, not the deputies, but I think for certain military officials are allowed... I know that there are provisions in election law that allow certain military officials to execute these items if they're over the rank of sergeant.
Okay.
So I believe that's part of it. I don't know if there are any other ranks that are.
Okay. It's current law in the bill, Senator Higgins. Apparently,
yes.
You can see
it.
Yeah, line 4.18. Any further discussions on Senate File 214? Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, since we have to have, since the bill does include this outrageous increase in a fee.
Really, truly outrageous.
Senator Betzel. It would have to be seen by the Finance Committee. So I move that Senate File 214, as amended, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, the other bill I have is Senate File 1224. And I do have an author's amendment. This is a bill that came from the Secretary of State's office, and it deals with their business legislation. So if we could adopt it's a technical amendment, the A1 amendment. If we could adopt that, then we do it. Now, the bill says referred to finance. Originally, it was sent to finance, but we realized this committee had to see some jurisdiction in here, so I made the motion on the floor to pull out of finance in here. So this is the first stop of this bill.
Okay, so the A1 amendment is an author's amendment to put the bill into shape. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, rather than walking through the bill, let me just describe generally what some of the high points of the bill, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Black to go from there. The Secretary of State's office receives a number of business filings, as you know, for assumed names, corporations, and they've been in the process of computerizing a lot of those systems in recent years. And so this bill tries to take care of some of those issues as well as others that are related to the filings. You have a two-page summary in your packet, actually a couple-page summary that kind of goes through the bill. But one of the things that we've seen in the State Government Budget Division is the fact that, for instance, trying to pay for the technology has been somewhat problematic. And so there's a temporary surcharge right now on people who file electronically, and that is due to expire. And that's one of the reasons it prompted us to get moving on some of the issues in this bill so we can extend that. But I'll turn it over to Mr. Black right now so he can identify some of the other major issues in this bill that we have to deal with in this one. Go ahead.
Mr. Black.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel. This bill is really the product of our professional staff who, in the process of writing the computer programs for the online filing project, which is due to be coming online in 12 to 15 months, they realized that we have a number of places where we have slightly different rules and slightly different provisions for the same kinds of business filings in different business types. And so a lot of what this bill is making things internally consistent in our business law. So, for example, the largest number, almost half the sections in this bill, provide for streamlining of the annual renewal process, for allowing us to centralize in the new section 5.34, which is section number 6, all the requirements for an annual renewal, so that you don't have to look through all these different sections. It allows us to start to collect email addresses for use as the official notice. These are email addresses provided to us by the business organization and allows us to send to the email addresses the notices that are required under the various business laws. It changes the assumed name filings. We have 190,000 assumed name filings on file. They've been around for almost a century. Not each one of them, but the institution of an assumed name filing. That's when you're doing business under a name that's not your corporate business name or under your own personal business name. They've previously had a 10-year duration, and then you renew them for another 10 years and pay a fee. That's different from everything else we do, everything else we do, you have a perpetual duration. So we're changing the assumed name filing to a perpetual duration, and we're taking out the paid renewal. There will be an annual renewal update, just like all the other businesses, so that'll make it consistent with all the other businesses. We have a situation with farm products. The central notification system, right now, you file a lien, and the check gets written both to the borrower and the lender. There's supposed to be a termination filed. Very often, there's the termination is not filed, and the farmer is pretty upset. And the reason it's not filed is because there's a fee on the back end. So we propose, and we've been working with the lenders on this, and the farmers, and the buyers, we propose that instead the initial fee be slightly more, and there be no fee on the back end for the termination. We believe that lack of a fee on the back end will make that paperwork show up, and then the farmer won't have to go down to the bank and get them to endorse the check when they sell their grain at the end of the growing season. We've got, other consistencies, trying to make the copy fees consistent throughout our current statutes. We have Section 5.12, which sets the copy fees for most items. We've got some tax liens, and we've got some UCC by number filings that we want to change those fees to make sure that they are consistent with 5.12. We take out a bulk discount that's been on the record for about 9 years now. This is a bulk discount. If you it caps your filing fee at $10,000 if you're making a registered office address change. This is something that, frankly, is difficult to program, and it's more equitable just to charge everybody the same fee no matter how many filings they've got. Finally, we've clarified some of the fees in limited partnerships, and also we are right now, this relates to the last bill as well, if you overpay your notary filing fee, we are not allowed to give you a refund unless you ask for it. We'd like to be allowed to automatically send out the refund just like we do on everything else. Again, it's an example of a slightly different rule that makes for a big computerization program problem. So that's basically what the bill is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel or Mr. Black, what control do you have over the assumed name that seems to me that I could go get a document and file it in a legal newspaper indicating that I was Target Corporation, for instance, or some other thing. And then when Target wanted to get back to use that name, they find out that they couldn't use it because you or someone else stick to get it. It's kind of like what happens on the computer where
right.
Mr. Black?
And Madam Chair and Senator Foley, that's, well, first of all, you must have ESP because on Tuesday, we're going to take up, I understand, Senator Olsen's bill, which is going to have some language in it that directly addresses that issue. But under current law, which is not changed in this bill, under current law, the assumed name cannot be, it must be distinguishable on our records from all the other business entity names that are not assumed names. In other words, assumed names may duplicate each other under Chapter 333.01. However, they cannot be the same as an existing corporation, limited liability company, limited partnership, or limited liability partnership name or a trademark. So in that case, if somebody were to try to file an assumed name for Target Corporation, they would be rejected. We would not take their filing because we have Target Corporation. It's obviously one of our biggest Minnesota corporations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Black, the individual, you failed to file for renewal. So you go in and someone else has already gotten that name, be as it may. Might be a Leo Foley situation or something of that nature.
And
Mr. Black?
And Madam Chair, that is exactly the language we're going to see with Senate File 1288 because that exact situation happened earlier this year with a number of companies in Minnesota. There was a fellow who was sort of name squatting, similar to the cyber squatting that I think Senator Betzel mentioned, that he took St. Olaf College. Anyone here from St. Olaf College? Augsburg College, Ecolab, iMation, a number of other names. This gentleman is, first of all, we were, because of the way the nonprofit law, corporation law works, we were able to deal with and help out St. Olaf and Augsburg College. The other corporations are Delaware or non-Minnesota corporations. I think most of them are Delaware corporations. And so their corporate existence was not bothered. But our solution on Tuesday, which we'll talk about on Tuesday, is going to be that when somebody fails to renew, we are going to make sure we are going to put a placeholder, a name holder in for 12 months. And so that even though they're dissolved, that name will be held for them for 12 months, and a person such as you described would not be able to file for that name upon dissolution.
We'll have that discussion on Tuesday, Mr. Black. So, Mr. Black, in summary, can you tell us there are new fees established in the bill?
Yes, there are yes. Some new fees that are established in the bill.
And so are there fee increases in the bill?
There are a number of minor fee increases in the bill. The main fee in this bill is actually, as Senator Betzel mentioned, the extension of the temporary surcharge, which is supported by the State Bar Association. There is a fiscal note that I think is on the system. The other fee increases changes. We actually have some fee decreases, too. The assumed name, the initial fee will go from $25 to $30, but the renewal fee will be removed. So over the course of 10 years, it actually goes down from $40 to $25. For the copy fees, we're going to $3 per filing instead of a per page item, because it's hard to computer can't calculate the number of pages. Right. They know how many filings there are. On the central notification system terminations, we're going from $20 initially to $25, but we're taking away the $20 termination fee. On the foreign corporation withdrawals, we are allowing them to withdraw without paying the annual report. Sometimes you'll find that a corporation wants to come back to do business, but if they have withdrawn, actually what they do is they don't pay the report and they don't withdraw, and then there's a very heavy penalty. So that's a barrier. On limited partnerships, we have a $15 additional fee, but we only get 70 of these a year, so it's a net of $1,000. Limited liability partnerships and limited partnerships will pay the reinstatement fee that everybody else pays, so that's a consistency issue. So there are some fees. It nets out to about $65,000 a year.
Anybody here to testify against this bill? Any further discussions? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1224, as amended, be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. We will recess till 1 o'clock.
Madam Chair, is it possible to confirm that we'll have the forensic laboratory bill up first after that?
Yes, Senator Orman, you
just wanted to make sure for my testifiers. Wanted to make sure. Thank you.
What time are we coming?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
And Senator Betzel,
25 minutes.
I have some pad thai brought in, so the members and the staff, we should. I'm sorry I can't give you an hour to eat, but I thought if I brought food in, you guys would be okay with it.
There's a great acronym.
I know. I don't get that one.
I noticed that the Secretary of State's other colleagues are the most.
It's a really ugly
Yeah.
You know,
well,
I gotta talk to him.
Yeah, you gotta talk to Bert with it. He reminds me of some CIA.
Oh, that's cute. How old is she?
Chris? Take your survey.
Big girl.
Critical.
Isn't that great?
Critical habitat license.
Oh. Hi. We get our tongue going.
There you go, the DNR page.
Yep, on our shirt.
Yeah. Oh, it's like 6 or 8 license plates.
Cute.